everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast, RPG Site's weekly podcast. I'm your host, Brian Vitale. Joining me, we have Josh Torres.
Season of open world action RPGs with time travel stories.
Mikhail Menani.
Season of coffee.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Galizio.
You know, when you put it that way, it's really weird that both of these games have this have very, very similar plots.
And Chaman Wu.
How's it going?
All right, so I have to open up, like, okay, you guys I know are alluding to Neo 3, but also, is it Code Vein is the other one? Is that
correct.
What you're talking about?
Correct. Oh,
I guess now that I'm thinking about it, like, yeah, that one did show up time travel and like they're in their trailer. So, okay, well, that's a good way to introduce what two games we're going to be talking about this week. So, of course, this is our last recording in January. Code Vein just released a couple days ago. We're going to touch on that as the first topic of this podcast. And then we'll go into Neo 3, which, of course, doesn't release in full until next week. But a sizable public demo was made available, and I know a handful of people on staff have made their ways through that. So we'll have a full discussion of Neo 3 next week, along with everything else coming out in February. But we'll also touch on the demo this week, because there's actually quite a bit to talk about there in terms of, well, we'll get into it. So yeah, two time-traveling, open-world, action game, RPG hybrids. So that's how we're going to start out. So yeah, Code Vein 2. This is a game that I cannot speak to directly because I've never played the original, but I know many of people on staff have, and I know that Josh, you've been able to go hands-on for at least a moderate amount into the newly released Code Vein 2. So we'll start there. I presume you've played the original. Compare it to the second game. Thoughts, feelings, compare it to Kazan, compare it to Souls, whatever you want. I don't know, like, what the most appropriate points of comparison are. But yeah, Code Vein 2.
Yeah, so the first Code Vein, you know, when people look back on it, they, you know, rightly refer to it as, like, it's an anime Souls-like. It's anime Dark Souls. It's very much, it you know, it's definitely one of those earlier ones that came out that was very inspired by the Dark Souls formula in terms of action RPGs and gave its own unique spin to it, and obviously heavily cel-shaded, very stylized anime aesthetic over it. And, you know, one of the things that people loved about it was, like, it had, like, one of the most robust character creators at the time. People oftenly joked, but now, you know, maybe it's 50-50 joked but serious of, like, hey, we got an awesome character creator with a game, you know, as an add-on to it, because people really loved that character creator in it. And Code Vein 2, just, you know, for people, heads up, obviously reviews from other outlets came out earlier this week. We didn't get early access review code or anything, so I got code when the early access for people who paid the expensive editions came out. So I'll work on, you know, I'm working through it, you know, at my own pace. There's not, like, a crazy deadline rush, at least, well, along with it, but it'll come when I'm done with it. With Code Vein 2, they have, it's a different format this time around, where it's still very much this Dark Souls-inspired pace and flow to combat. But much like Neo 3, they decided, both Code Vein and Neo, hey, our next entries should go open world. Maybe both were inspired by Elden Ring, who knows? You know, I can see it, but you never know. Obviously, Neo 3 has a little bit more going on when we get into that, because, you know, Team Ninja released Rise of the Ronin before it, and definitely built upon that foundation in interesting ways for that, and get around to it. Code Vein 2 is, I don't know, like, I like it for the same reasons I like the first one, in the sense that, like, it has a really great character creator, expanded a lot of, like, you know, options in the way that you can dress up your character with different outfits, and even taking parts of different outfits and, like, meshing that together. So if, like, you like an outfit that has, like, a cloak or a shirt, you can take those specific parts and keep them. And then if you like another outfit's, like, skirt or pants or jeans or whatever crazy things that it's working on the lower half of it, you can combine it with that. They included things like, hey, you can edit, like, the color of your fingernails. You can stylize, you know, like, you can go into a lot of minutiae about the character creator and you know, get something highly, highly, you know, stylized to your sensibilities. and so forth. So that's still great that, like, you know, they really, you know, doubled down on expanding that character creator. And if you, you know, paid for expensive editions, you get more like color options, for example, than for people who really wanted that and wanted to spend extra. And that doesn't affect gameplay experience on that end. But because it's like it's such an this inclusion of the open world of like, okay, times have really, you know, changed in terms of like what people expect out of open worlds, especially in the action RPG space where Elden Ring sold so much and people are used to that and are expecting, you know, things to follow along that style. Code Vein feels almost outdated in a certain sense because the open world aspect of it feels even like, you know, Elden Ring definitely has like empty stuff in its open world, but you know, you could find interesting landmarks in it, while Code Vein, there's collectibles you can find to, you know, upgrade your healing resources. You can find like little collectibles on the ground to craft buffs and food and stuff like that. And there are landmarks that you can enter that are like sort of like mini dungeons that lead to mini dungeons in a sense. But the in between those, it just feels really barren. It feels really uninteresting. I think the one thing that's really interesting about the way it does its open world, because it is a time travel plot, where the basis of the plot is I guess I should lead this by saying Code Vein 2 does not follow up directly from the events of Code Vein 1. It is Final Fantasy style, where even though this is there's a number 2 in the title, it is its own separate game apart from 1, which I can definitely see why people who played Code Vein 1 are disappointed that Code Vein 2 is its own separate, isolated story away from that, because the ending of Code Vein 1 led to some really interesting world building where you find out, hey, this is actually in the world of God Eater in Code Vein 1. It's like, oh shit, I really wonder where they're going to go with that plot. And they just decided to shy away from that entirely, unfortunately. So Code Vein 2, you're awoken as, like, you know, this revenant hunter, and you're kind of put into the plot very quickly. It's a very, very kind of almost bare bones premise at the very beginning. You're awoken by this character named Lou. She has a really bizarre design where, like, her chest has like a gaping hole, and you see her heart, like a golden heart in that hole. So like a lot of her chest is like, it's just a gaping hole. People who've seen like promo material of this game, like, it's like, see this character, it's like, wow, that's a really bizarre looking character. And she has the power to time travel. This power isn't complete at first, but she has the power to time travel 100 years into the past, because the current present that you're awoken in is pretty much a ruined world already. There's these things called the resurgence that happens that has disrupted, like, you know, the land, and everything is kind of in ruins and fucked up. And it's just humans and revenants trying to survive, and revenants are ostensibly vampires in this game. So in order to try and sort of like recover the state of the world, try to figure out what's happening, you need Lou's time travel power to go 100 years back in the past and try to wipe out these individuals that would become heroes, because the state of the world that it's in the present is because the heroes are, you know, in their current state, totally fucking it up. Like, they're like in these cocoons, and he had to find a way to break these cocoons that the heroes are in. And in order to do that, you need to find like a key 100 years into the past where they were still alive and present, and you need to find something in that past to awaken them in the present and slay them. Essentially, it's a really,
I do like how, like, even for stories that are relatively straightforward, just explaining time travel stories is never easy.
Exactly. Like, it sounds convoluted, it's straightforward, it don't think too much about it. It's not like, it's not the deepest story to wrap your head around. But because of, like, you're constantly time traveling between the past and the present, you do see noticeable changes in the environment in the present when you change something in the past. A very early example is your first companion character after Lou is Noah. And you, in the present, when you wake up, you see Noah petrified, facing off against this monster. And when you go travel to the past, you meet Noah and you find out, you know, what events led up to him facing off against this monster. You save him. And so, and you save him and the people there. So in doing so, Noah is now alive in the present. He didn't get petrified for all time against that monster. And the people working at that base in the past with Noah were able to survive that assault. So people who were like working under construction projects like bridges were able to finish them because they didn't get wiped out during that event in the past. So now, 100 years back into the present, this bridge is now complete. So you have access to a new area, like a new island. And then there's like other stuff, like, you know, then like the next big section that you unlock after that bridge is this whole story about this hero named Josie, and like this is all takes place in like this polluted, sunken city. So you travel back to the past, meet Josie, learn about like her life and the people around her there. And after that whole section, you are able to get clean water again to these people in the past. So now in the present, that whole area is now transformed, where it's not so run down and there's clean water. So there's more explorable areas now because you've unlocked and kind of fixed up that section in the present. So there's like cool things about it where you'll see like little things like in the environmental design and like the structures that are distinctly, you know, they have a past version and a present version. I'm like, I think that's cool where they're able to at least depict the effect, the cause and effect of time travel in terms of the environmental surroundings around you. And I think
that's, when you describe that on paper, yeah, that sounds real neat. Like being able to be like, hey, this was all poisoned. I, you know, the story or the narrative kind of pushes me to go to the past and correct a few issues and then come back and I have additional world space to explore because I accomplished a thing. Like on paper, it sounds really neat.
Yeah. I think the unfortunate timing of Code Vein 2 releasing so close to like this public demo of Nioh 3 and Nioh 3 coming out next week is the combat in it is a very different, slower pace. While people freaking love Nioh 3 combat, it's very chaotic, sporadic, fast-paced. Like, you are on it, and we'll get into, like, Nioh 3 shaking up the formula of the its samurai ninja stances. But this is kind of in a weird scenario where I was able to play Nioh 3 before Code Vein 2 came out. So I was already used to Nioh 3, and going into Code Vein 2, which I'm, you know, assigned to review, I'm like, okay, I have to rewire my brain. This isn't Nioh 3. Code Vein 1, you know, also had that same kind of slower-paced, methodical combat, where you can do, like, some cool stuff, but you are still bound by this Dark Souls-esque, like, you know, system. It doesn't, like, it's faster-paced in the sense that you have more over-the-top tools, but Nioh 3, obviously, has gotten, you know, it really refine and perfect its formula. It's no longer like almost this weird, you know, with the first Nioh 1 where it still was trying to find its identity in the flow of combat. Nioh 3 has kind of found its own pace in it. So that's the interesting thing about it. Code Vein 2 is the way that it does its like systems, the way that you build up your character, is an extension of Code Vein 1, where you get these, you know, currency, souls currency in it to level up, but you don't level up stats individually. You level it up all in one go, linearly. So like when you go to level 1 to level 2, it auto levels up all these stats, like base stats for you in minimal ways, and that doesn't really affect your build as much. Like you get a little bit of health, a little bit of stamina, a little bit of like +1/+2 attack power on your weapons. But the main thing that's really affecting like your damage output, your build identity, are these things called blood codes. blood codes are something that you get when you help out characters in the main story, when you meet new characters, when you forge bonds with them, like Noah, for example, when you, you know, do his character thing in the main story, he'll give you his blood code. And these blood code affect, like, your actual attributes, like dexterity, willpower, mind, etc., and have their own additional passive effects. Like, if you are not overburdened on these attributes, meaning, like, you didn't, like, over-exceed, like, the stat attribute cap that will give you, you know, debuffs if you do. If you're not overburdened, you will get, like, something like reduced stamina consumption. And then if you reach, like, thresholds, like, in the mind and dexterity, if you reach, like, mind 3 and dexterity 5, you know, you'll get this passive buff to you. So there's a lot of balancing of, like, how, of what sort of build you want to go to, whether it's ranged or melee, and what sort of combat approach. There, you kind of have to balance these attributes and the, these passive buffs, because it rewards you by doing it well. So if you, like, get overburdened, like, in two main attributes, you will have a slower dodge roll, so you'll have, like, a heavy roll, like in Dark Souls. And that's, you know, very, you know, it doesn't feel good to move around and dodge roll, and you'll be way more vulnerable when you try to do evasive maneuvers. Meanwhile, if you are, if you build well and you're able to balance your main attributes, so all of them are less than halfway than their overburden. So, like, there's, like, they have, like, a meter beneath them, like, say, the willpower meter or attribute. If you go over that meter, it gets overburdened. But if you are able to get it under halfway for not only that, but all attributes, you get a really fast, like, not dodge roll, like a quick step, like in Bloodborne almost.
Wait, clarify something for me. I thought you mentioned that you don't change your stats individually, but you do have these attributes that you manage individually.
Yeah, you don't manage these stats like through, like, using soul currency to level them up like Dark Souls. You use them by equipping blood codes, and blood codes don't, they all have, like, they're all, you, blood codes aren't something that, like, you choose the stats one by one to plus one, plus two, plus three. It's like, hey, Noah's blood code gives you, like, minus 5 dexterity, minus 5 mind, plus 7 willpower, plus 7 strength, etc. So they're all pre-configured already. You don't actually, like, minutely go plus one, plus two on, like, the stats individually. Like,
and these, the way you're describing them, are they unique to Code Vein 2, the blood codes?
These are in the first Code Vein as well. So this is like kind of like the primary way that Code Vein differentiates itself from, like, other Souls likes in the market, where a lot of your build comes down to what you equip. So it's not like you don't have to respec like in other games. Like, you don't need to have, like, be handed an item or have a free respec. These equipping other blood codes is how you spec into other builds. Like, you can only equip one blood code at a time, and they all have, like, a proficiency meter. So, like, when you, let's say I equip, like, this grade D glue blood code, which gives me these, you know, it has its stat layout and whatnot. But once I finish, like, the proficiency level of grade D and talk with Lou, she'll give me a grade C of her blood code, and that's an even better version that has, like, better, like, balancing of the stats and more bonuses, more powerful effects, etc. On that, so there's, like, a mastery to it, and when you master blood codes in Code Vein 2, you can actually, like, talk to this really tall, curvy girl, like, woman named Lavinia. She's kind of like the overseer of the organization where Lou is working, and now you're working for. And once you master, like, blood code, she'll give you boosters that you can equip onto your character. Like, you can easily swap these boosters in and out, but these boosters are, like, you know, dexterity plus two. If you equip this booster, this certain weapon will have more damage, and you can equip up to 4 of these boosters and so forth. And boosters are also, like, an additional way for you to balance your burden on individual stats. So, like, say, like, the boosters are, like, dexterity plus 2 and plus 5. If you equip both of them, you have plus 7 to dexterity, so you're lessening the load of your dexterity stat. So you're able to like equip weapons that scale off of dexterity and at the same time lighten the burden of dexterity on you. It's like, it's one of those things, like, it's difficult to conceptualize if you've never seen it in front of you, but I swear to God that, like, it makes more sense once you see it in the UI, because the way that, like, you describe this system, it's like, this sounds, like, fucking insane. It's like, a little bit, but once you, like, get used to, like, how your build, your character build is basically modular from the things that you equip on you. That is the TLDR on the whole thing. That's what makes, like, building a character in Code Vein cool, like both Code Vein games, because you can have like a dual blades build, a bayonet build, a big heavy broadsword build, and like you can experiment with these like weapons and like proper builds for them on the fly instead of like having to do a respec item that may or may not be, you know, restrictive depending on the game. Instead of like having to go through that hassle, you just like equip different blood codes, different weapons, different boosters, and then you're, you know, pretty much ready to go experiment with like different playstyles on the fly instead of like, you know, having to work through the minutiae of it all. So like my current build is like, I really like bayonets. So I'm working towards like a really cool bayonet build where I'm able to zoom around with this dodge skill. And then be able to, you know, use like this power shot maneuver to deal like a lot of damage from a distance and stuff. And the thing that another system on top of like just your health and stamina is this resource called Icor. It's basically your MP bar, but it's numerical. So like you have this Icor numerical value at the center of your screen. Let's say and this is all dictated by blood code. Let's say I equip a blood code that has like a max I-core cap of like 24. That means I'm able to use this power shot maneuver, which costs 4 I-core, 4 mana, a brief amount before I have to recharge it. And then in order to recharge that I-core, you or your partner, AI partner character, companion partner character, use this maneuver called, like, I think it's like a drain attack, and which is like dictated by like, you know, another weapon on top of your main weapon. So you have your main weapon, an eventual secondary weapon slot that you can unlock, and like this this drain weapon, which comes in the form of, or like drain forma or whatever it's called, I forgot already. And this could come in like very like different forms. Like one early one is like summoning bats. So like you grow character like bat wings for a sec and fling bats at an enemy, and when those bats hit an enemy, they reward you some I-core back, you get some mana back, and you have more resources. Another like I-core or forma drain attack, whatever, is like a scythe, and this scythe is cool because it's totally different from the bat one. You spin the scythe before you slash with it, and during that spin animation, you can actually parry an attack during that animation if it hits with you during that time frame. And then when you hit them with a scythe, you get some I-core back. You can charge these attacks to get more I-core back. So you kind of have this, you're balancing all these different things along with balancing your mana resources to be able to continue your offense and, you know, take defensive measures when need be. And along the way, you always have like a companion character with you who's actually useful, you know, on their own, taking aggro, doing some damage, giving you some breathing room if like a boss is really up on you. But they also serve as like a second chance. So like, let's say you die in combat and your partner character is still alive. They'll be able to revive you as long as they're still on the field. Like they'll actually like just like auto revive you. You don't have to wait for them like running over to you. They're like, you'll like, they'll almost like you'll absorb them in order to revive at like half health, and then this will get lower as, you know, you get more auto revives, and then they'll auto, and then your partner character will respawn after a certain amount of time, and. So you can, if you're able to like, you know, survive while they're still on cooldown, for example, if they're summoned back to the field, you'll get another auto revive as long as they're on the field. Obviously, the more you fall down in combat and get auto revive, the longer it takes for them to respawn, essentially. But if you're the type of person like, hey, I don't like playing with a partner character, I don't want them like taking the aggro of my opponents, I want to do this on my own, there's an option for you to just like either disable them from like the bonfires, or you can like absorb them from the field, so you have like buff stats and you know, and they won't be on the field either. So those are two ways to disable those partner characters if you don't want them. I think one of the big things going from Code Vein 1 to Code Vein 2 that they actually cut out is, in Code Vein 1, there was online multiplayer. You can play, you know, with other people. In Code Vein 2, it's entirely single player now. They cut out all the multiplayer components from it. But it just kind of sucks. Like, people really did, like,
play co-op Code Vein 1. I know a couple of people that straight up have not bought this because they wanted the co-op.
Yeah, absolutely. I see that. So I think it's a bizarre decision. But, you know, maybe it was, like, one of those things that they unfortunately had to cut with this, you know, move to open world, the open world structure. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of the big, like, you know, lowdown on Code Vein 2. It's like, there are things I like about it. There are things it feels outdated in a sense. And obviously the big talk about it is just the optimization around its, both the console and the PC version. It's still like in a rough state in all the platforms. That it's on. Like, I know when I booted up the game on my desktop PC, I have a 3080. It will, like, the average frame rate performance of it is, like, anywhere between, like, 40 to 55 FPS-ish. So it doesn't, like, it kind of feels choppy on that. I've actually installed an engine INI tweak with it that raised my performance from 40 to 55 FPS to more around, like, 60 to 75-ish FPS, which on average, which feels better. Though when it's loading up new areas, it will like dip down into the 20s briefly for like a few seconds when it's loading up as this new area. Also, like the cutscenes by default run at 30 FPS, that they have a cap of 30 FPS. There's no way to change that in the game unless you mod it. So unlike Neo 3, which just like looks better in comparison, because Neo 3 gives you the option to go to 60 or 120 FPS for cutscenes, raise that cutscene FPS cap. While in Code Vein 2, it doesn't give you that option. There is like a PC mod to unlock that, get rid of that frame rate cap on it, so cutscenes do, run a bit smoother on my machine, because I installed those two mods to make it, you know, feel better to play, which doesn't, you know, seem great.
And also, just to add a little bit of context, then Mikhail, you mentioned earlier that we got review code late. I'm pretty sure the reason is because we requested a Steam PC version. And if you look at Metacritic right now for the PC version of Code Vein 2, there's, I think, one review from PC Gamer, and it was like a couple days ago. So my point is that no one had really early access to the to the PC version, and maybe they were like optimizing it to the very last second as much as they could, because they knew that it wasn't necessarily, you know, up to snuff or whatnot. So it wasn't just us. It was just like that PC version might have been coming in relatively hot. Go for it, Mikhail.
Yeah, I was curious what you thought of the music so far in Code Vein 2, because like Code Vein 1 soundtrack was fantastic. I haven't played much of Code Vein 2 yet, but yeah, like just curious about
that.
I've heard good things about the soundtrack for 2. It's Goshina again, right?
I don't know. I don't know if it's exactly Goshina. I don't know if there's a confirmed credits for Goshina. I know people really like Code Vein 1's OST because of Goshina, and that was confirmed. I don't know if, like, I haven't seen credits on who exactly did the music yet on the tracks for Code Vein 2, but the Code Vein 2 soundtrack is, it's kind of a weird, like, it feels weirdly, I don't know if out of place is the word. It's like, the quality of the tracks is really good. It's very grandiose and orchestral, but the visuals and atmosphere that you're like witnessing in the game, it feels too grandiose for like a lot of like the cutscenes. Like, for example, like you have like this you saw this at like a preview event, this like this story battle at like the aquarium. And after that boss battle, you go into a cutscene, but like it feels like that cutscene is a little bit melancholic for what Josie is processing at that moment. But the backing OST feels very grandiose and up like it just feels too grand for like the events that it's portraying. And I feel like this happens to like in the game way more often than like I would like to, because I feel in my mind this game is like it's a very melancholic atmosphere because you're trying to find a way to like almost repair the world through this time travel story. But the backing track is like the tracks themselves are like fantastic, but for what the scene and the tone is going for in that scene, it feels too grandiose. And
you know
opinion.
What that reminds me of?
That's my only complaint. Yeah.
It reminds me of Xenoblade Chronicles Cross, where Elma is giving you the tutorial of like the squads.
Oh, yeah.
And for some reason, the backing track for that from the composer, what's his name? I forget.
Sawano.
Sawano is just like super, upbeat and, all encompassing.
Yeah.
It's just like, why are you playing this over this like kind of dry tutorial of like, there are 8 squads here.
Yeah.
I have a question for you. Can you explain to me why there's a musical? I'm curious to try out this game because this bad guy sings this musical or something.
So one of the promo things that they release is like one of the companions you meet in the game. I haven't met him yet. I can't answer that question for you because I'm not that far in the game yet. But one of his companions, like, he kind of looks, he has his mask, he looks kind of like, he looks a little bit edgy in his design, but then when you watch the trailer, it plays out like almost like a Disney musical. He has a fantastic voice in English, and then in Japanese, he's voiced by Koyasu, very, very famous, Japanese voice actor. And, it feels like a Disney musical, and it just defies expectations based on the character design that you're seeing going in. I don't know what this dude's deal is. I'm really interested to, like, meet him in the game and see what he's all about. Like, his name's like, thank you, Adam. Zenon Grife Goat, I guess is that, or Griff Goat. I don't know how you pronounce his last name. Yeah, I don't know. But it's a really interesting, character archetype. I think the companion characters are like interesting, like in the way that they're what their backstories are and what circumstances led them to do what they did. I think the presentation of like their backgrounds is a little bit, once again, outdated, because anytime that like a story scene happens that needs to like delve into like the character's background and like important character NPCs surrounding them, it goes into this flashback segment where you're transported into like this almost dream sequence, but this dream sequence is basically a straight line that you can only walk, not run across. So you're slowly walking through this dream sequence of like different events and conversations that that happened in their past, and you're just like holding the left stick forward, and that's it, as these conversations are happening, and you're just, that's it. After these conversations happen along the way, they'll construct more of the path for you to move forward until you reach a door to exit out of this. And this happens like almost constantly when you're doing the main story sections, which is, once again, there was a time when video games did this, and they've done it less and less over the years, while Code Vein 2 is like, this is what I do. It's like, all right, well, games do this less often these days, and for good reason, because it's not an effective storytelling tool for me.
It's basically like a cutscene only without any of the actual like cutscene choreography, and it's your interaction is just hold forward.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, that doesn't. Yeah, I can see why people are like first impressions are, they're obviously them not having co-op, big bummer for a good chunk of the audience who like Code Vein. Obviously the move to open world isn't driving with a lot of people, both for optimization issues, but also because the open world structure and design isn't all that interesting, like to traverse through. And like the gameplay is, if you like Code Vein gameplay, it will give you this. It'll give you like this, versatile builds and like what to go, you know, presenting you options on what to go for, different weapons and weapon types, and you know, all this mishmash of how you want to play. Like, it does excel, like, if you're interested in, like, the character creating and almost like theory crafting builds, I think it excels at that. But I think a lot of like the things surrounding the gameplay at the moment that I'm in is, you know, it's more of a hassle than it needs to be, especially because the overall performance of this game is just, it feels dire sometimes, even with the optimization mods that I put into it. It doesn't feel great to play sometimes because of the optimization of it.
Obviously, we'll keep tabs on Codebane 2 as you play through that and write up your final thoughts. Do we know, how long was the original game? Like, whenever I think open world, I'm like, all right, this game's going to be twice as long as the last one. I wonder if that'll be true for Neo as well.
Yeah, Codebane is maybe 20, 25 hours. If you're really, if you're more attentive, brief, like, it's like maybe 30 short. Plus. Yeah, so, like, Codebane, you know, like, not too long of a game. I imagine, I don't know how long Codebane 2 is going to be. I imagine it's going to be, like, maybe 40-ish on average is my ballpark guess.
And very rarely do we have the two games that we're talking about end up being like compared to each other in a really genuine fashion, other than the fact that they just happen to like be talked about on the same day, because we're going to go straight from Codebane 3 to talking about Neo 3. So this will be a little bit of an abbreviated talk, because we're going to go full details of Neo 3 next week. But we talked about the demo is very extensive, and many of us have had our hands on the demo, including, I know you, Josh. I'm going to hand the microphone off over to Adam to start out talking about Codebane 3 demo, Neo 3 demo.
Codebane 3 demo, let's go.
Yeah, but I know others have also played it. Not me yet. I'm working on other things. So I know Mikhail and Josh and others will chime in. But Adam, I know you booted up the Neo 3 demo. I was watching you play it a little bit last night. I know you were a big fan of Neo 2, and I think you were a relatively big fan of Neo 1 as well. So just, you know, take us away, and what did you think of the demo so far, and are you looking forward to the full release next week?
Yeah, so I got to play Neo 3 last year at a preview event.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, so I kind of was already, you know, familiar with, like, the, you know, besides the ninja samurai switching style stuff, when you're playing the demo that I was playing in when I went to their offices last year, like the first thing that hits you, like, oh, this is different, is the world map. Like, the original games had no map. Like, the first two games, you're in levels, there's no map, very individual, you're trying to find shortcuts, kind of in that, you know, level design to get to a boss, fight the boss, and you complete the game in stages. I remember the demo that I played at Koei Tecmo's offices. I fight a boss, and it's a great boss. Neo, the Neo series is a lot of really fun, really high energy bosses. And then it's kind of, I was expecting, kind of from, you know, history with the games.
Muscle memory.
Muscle memory to like kick me to the world, to kick me to like a menu, like choose your next level. And it's like, nope, that doesn't happen. It kicks you back out onto a world map. I'm like, wait, where am I? What am I doing now? And it did feel a little bit awkward, but, so here in the public demo, it starts out with a tutorial. You are in a sort of like dojo. It's the sort of things you expect. It's like, pick your weapon. Now let's try it. Let's, you know, give you a reminder of how these Neo games play and whatnot. And then, you get attacked. You do like a tutorial sequence, where you're going through a relatively linear stage with no map. And at the end of that, you do kind of fight a boss battle that you cannot win. It kind of kicks off the events of the game. Basically, your brother is, your main character's brother is jealous that you were going to be chosen Shogun. So he kind of rallies the demon yokais to like fight on his behalf, because he wants to be Shogun really, really badly, I guess. And you get flung through time. And then in the second part of the demo, you're in a world map, like an open world. You pull up a menu and a map, which you've never had before in Neo, and there's all of a sudden it's like, you have a compass and there's some icons and there's stuff to pick up, and it's like, oh, this is different. If you played Rise of the Ronin, it has, you know, it's very evident that some of that philosophy has brought itself here, including, for example, like an exploration level. So you find different icons on the map. They can be valuables. They can be scampuses, the little fat ball cat things, kodamas. There's a new creature that's called a Chijiko, which is like a flying ferret weasel thing. There are enemy bases, kind of like in a lot of open world games. You go into a base, kill all the enemies, and it unlocks it or opens it for you. There's crucible spikes. There's like, which are like, they're kind of like little mini wave-based battle arena things. And you knock these things off, and there's literally a checklist in the menu, like quite literally check boxes and check marks. And as you fill those up, you raise your exploration level, which can give you stats and give you other bonuses for doing that. So it's one of those things where it is to your benefit to explore and do these things, because you do become a more powerful character when you do that. Now, all the combat stuff is still really good, very, very similar to the other Neo games. There's a couple of big differences, of course, with like the jumping, because some enemies now fly. There's some new enemies that are like, they clearly took this into a consideration with enemies that are now flying. But then the biggest difference with the combat is how they separated your samurai abilities and your ninja abilities.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that before we get to the ninja, the exploration levels, like, it's also to the benefit of like people who like collectibles, because like in Rise of the Ronin, where you go into the zone, you don't see anything yet, and you kind of go along the path and see, like, you know, do different activities, whether it's like, you know, getting a Kodama, chasing down Stampuses. I forgot what the new one was, where you have to like, they're now in the air. Yeah, and you, they're another cute animal that you get to collect. You can also do, like, you know, stuff like clearing out enemy bases like you did in Rise of the Ronin. But once you get to like the max level exploration level 4, it'll show you all the collectibles in that region, just like in Rise of the Ronin. So it is to your benefit, like you mentioned, not only just stats, but for people who like collectibles, there's no guesswork. Like, where's this Kodama on the map or this region? Just like raise your exploration level, max it out, and it'll be all indicated on the map, and you're free to just get them at your leisure. No having to like look up a guide or something in that respect. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, I mean, and so of course there's the exploration level stuff. It does change the pacing of the game a bit, because obviously in the first two Neo games they're more level based, and every level has a boss at the end. You know, obviously the main levels had like the bespoke, you know, story-centric important bosses, where other levels, like maybe side missions and whatnot in Neo games, might just have like a mini boss or a pair of bosses, like a kind of a more regular enemy, or maybe like, you know, some sort of encounter at the end. But there was sort of a pace to it. You start a level, all the levels are relatively the same length, you know, I guess main and side levels, and then you fight a boss at the end, you go to the next, and there's kind of there's a cadence, a pace to it, where now it's like, you're exploring the world, and there's multiple directions you can go, and there are like formidable enemies on the world map and whatnot. And sometimes, open world style, you might find like a big kind of mini boss on the world map, and it's like, should I take this guy out now or should I come back later? And you can make that decision. Whereas in Neo, there being all level based, you had to progress through the level, you know, in the way that it went, right? You didn't have a choice. You can maybe choose which level you were playing, but otherwise, so the pacing in the game is definitely different now. Haven't played enough to say if it's better or worse, but it is something that I can easily see this being a reason why you might like Neo 3, or a reason you might not like it, because that open world kind of zone framing is very different than a level-based game.
Yeah.
right
you have to consider, like, it's a 360 degree, like, you know, explorable area now, and like the linear stages, so, you know, a very viable tactic now is just like the hit and run, because like in Rise of the Ronin, like the enemy sight is fairly limited in this game, like it was in Rise of the Ronin, so it's very easy to just like, you know, do a sneak attack and then go back and like take a few steps away, and then they're like, oh, where are you, and then you can just do it again. Stuff like that you can just do now.
Also important to mention, so in the demo, if you played it, like at the last part of the demo is something called a crucible. And a crucible in Neo's case, Neo 3's case, is basically a level. Like, it's their way of saying, like, hey, did you miss the levels from Neo 1 and Neo 2? Well, here is a level. So you're in the Hamamatsu region, which is kind of the demo region of the game. You're trying to get to the castle. And then there's like a big kind of demon realm in the way, and they call this a crucible, and you basically enter it, and it basically, in a sense, takes you off the world map. Like, it separates you, divorces you from the world map for a moment, and puts you in this level. And in the Crucible level, you don't really have a map. You do have like a radar, and it does show you some icons on the radar, so it's not like you're completely blind, but it doesn't, it's not really part of the world map anymore. So those are the moments.
They have the lamppost, like, yes. There's a spirit with you that, like, that will actually like highlight your path, like, along the main path. Like, it's basically just telling you, hey, you're on the main path, you're not getting sidetracked, this is where you need to go. Which is probably, you know, people had some complaints of that with past the
Yeah, you're getting lost. Like, where's the one path that you need to go to progress? Yeah. Now there's a little lamp that shows you go this way. There's little side paths, just like there are in previous Neo games, where it's like you go over here, there might be a collectible or an item, you know, like a samurai lock or ninja lock, which are the things that allow you to get skill points or whatnot. But yeah, and then that Crucible in the demo ends with basically the boss of the demo. The name I don't remember. It's like a woman with like a flame snake head and an ice demon head, like arm things that you fight. It's a pretty fun boss, really. And I think kind of it's like, you know, the first major boss of the game, really. So nothing too, you know, impossible. I think very manageable, but kind of, you know, it's very fun to play. And in terms of combat, I'm liking this just as much as I like the previous Neo games. I will admit that I, in playing the demo, have stuck mostly with samurai style, and I only switched to ninja style. I should mention this, actually. You switch to between the two styles at the press of a button, right? It's your right trigger if you're playing with a controller. And the game, I think I mentioned this when I did the earlier demo last year. Enemies do like their wind-up attacks. I forget what they're called, but they glow red, and it's an attack that you cannot block. So what you're supposed to do with those attacks is you're supposed to counter them, right? And how the game does this, like, by default, is that you actually press the stance style switch button to counter those attacks. So you like get attacked with a big wind-up attack, you counter it, and then it automatically switches you to the other style, ninja to samurai or samurai to ninja. And I think that's kind of an interesting decision, because it sort of forces you to have that like switch off to do that. And so I usually play in samurai style, and I only switch to ninja style very infrequently when I'm like countering people, and I'll play with it a bit, but then I usually turn back to samurai because I'm a creature of habit.
I'm the inverse. I've been a ninja main, rarely touching samurai. This is the thing that might, you know, for people who play Neo and know Neo, they're fine with it, but this is definitely something that might break people, because the samurai style and ninja style are distinctly treated as different characters, even in the character creator. So if you wanted to make like a male samurai and a female ninja, go for it. So like,
I didn't know you did that.
So when you switch between the styles, you have a totally different character appearance and different everything, you know. So like, people have been experimenting, like Rod and My Half. Like, if people know Rod and My Half, you know, they made like their character like that, which is pretty awesome that the game allows you to do that. But because like they're treated as two separate characters, their whole entire equipment set is also treated as different. So you are gearing not one, but two entirely different characters, because samurais have their own unique set of weapons and armor, and ninja has their unique set of weapons and armor. So you are making almost twice decision-making in terms of like gearing your characters, unless you're really vigilant about like not touching the other stance at all. And you can do that. Like, you're perfectly fine to like, hey, I only want to switch with stick to samurai or ninja. So like, the only time you either engage with them or not is like countering these red shift attacks, or like just dodging them entirely and just continue playing like that style. And that's totally fine.
I should mention that I was going to mention this. The game actually does give you the option to go in the menu and kind of uncouple the counter button with the style shift button. So if you want, you can stay in samurai style or ninja style and still do the counter. And like, obviously counters are valuable, because
I forgot that it gave you the option to do that. That's really cool, actually.
I haven't messed with it, so I don't know if there's any caveat there. I'm not aware of it. But yeah, so ideally you should be able to, basically, if you want, just stick with one style or the other and never even bother with the other style.
Yeah.
Now, there are some advantages to like ninja versus samurai. Like, samurais can do the ki pulse stuff, which is maybe important for the some enemies, like to do their little like demon vortex, yokai vortex portal pool things. You know what I'm talking about. I forget what they're called. That you want to clear out. Ninjas can't do that, but they do use less ki in general compared to the samurai, so they can do like longer chains of attacks without having to worry about their stamina too much or their ki too much. And then there are some other advantages. For example, ninjas do more damage from the backside of enemies. So like
instead of the ki pulse, they can, like, if you press R1, you can dodge like in a direction through like an enemy. So yep.
And so like they have their own like utility, and it, like, a relatively common and kind of obvious strategy is if you knock down a boss or an enemy and they're staggered for a bit, you can do your like grapple attack and then kind of go behind them as a ninja and attack them with whatever your ninja loadout is, and you'll do more damage. Just ninjas just have that inherent property. They do more damage from the backside compared to like samurais who don't, that just doesn't happen. I've been primarily playing with samurai, switching to ninja like here and there, but I actually find myself like, I have my samurai build. I'm very happy with it. My equipment makes sense, works well together. And my ninja build, like my equipment is just kind of like hodgepodge, just like whatever, just slap it on and not as thoughtful. And they take more damage because I'm not as careful with the build. Like, I should probably give my ninja build more attention. But you do have to now, because you now, like you said, you have two totally separate equipment builds that you needed to worry about.
Yeah, I really like ninja. They also have like a more of a focus, like they have like actual like skills in the air that you can use.
Yes.
So there's like a mid air focus that you can do with ninja as well. They obviously all of the ninja stools, ninjutsu stuff have been like allocated to the ninja. While in like previous games, you could kind of make like almost a hybrid build. On this one, if you want access to those, there is, you know, ninja is for that, because yeah, like recharging like ninja tools and ninjutsu. Of course, both samurai and ninja have access to Onyo magic. Mm-hmm. For those, and also the neat thing is, even though like both samurai and ninja can use one-handed and two-handed swords, like the ninja variant of one-handed and two-handed are treated as completely different weapons, different yes. move sets, different abilities. So they're just like essentially like new weapons made for the ninja style, even though they on the surface it looks the same, but it's completely different in the way that they play, which is really cool. But it's kind of interesting, because at the beginning of the game I thought, oh my god, did they get rid of the stance system? But oh, yeah. No, the low stance and the high stance from the previous games, you unlock them now once you get access to the open world. So like, you have to remember, it's like, oh, they didn't get rid of it. You just have to unlock it in the samurai tree. While ninja doesn't have any stances at all. If people found the stance system intimidating in previous games, they were totally fine just sticking with one stance, and you can complete the game with just their preferred stance, and that was totally fine. While ninja is like, you don't have to worry about any stances at all. You have a different set of tools that you can manage with them. So for people who might have been shied away from these games because they found the stance system intimidating, maybe like the new ninja style that doesn't give you that option entirely, you know, you might be able to, you know, this might be your like entry into the Neo series, because you might enjoy the ninja style because it just completely, you know, changes the way that you engage with the game, play the game, and that's totally cool. Like, I've been really liking the ninja style, because it, you know, you, like, for example, I am doing like a electric ninja build. So I have the option to like build a lot of like electricity build up on enemies to stun them, so they move slower, so I'm able to maneuver more easily mm-hmm. around them and do like, you know, back damage. So it's like, it's really cool. Like, I really enjoy it. Like, I thought, I was very hesitant at first. I was like, I don't know how I'm gonna feel about this game with this whole open world style and the whole the new ninja style, but I think I'm okay with the way that they separate samurai and ninja. And also the zones themselves are fairly, like, they're not super big. Like,
no.
The points of interest is all along, like, you know, like at roads, routes at the end of them. And so, like, the moment-to-moment action is still fairly consistent, because the route to get to place is fairly, it's not a long trip to get to like the next point of interest. Like, there's not a lot of like empty space in between like things you want to explore in the open world, which is, you know, I appreciate. I'm glad that's not like a very big, vast open world in each region. Like, you can find things to do fairly quickly in them.
Yeah, we should probably couch more discussion for the full release next week.
Right.
I do think it's worth mentioning two things, though. One, you don't have to play Neo 1 and Neo 2 to play this one. It's it takes like its own premise, and as we know, you kind of like hop through time to like different parts of, you know, Japanese history, from Warring States period to Bakumatsu period to before that. So you can start with this one. You're not merely missing anything. There's even in the game somewhere there's going to be some, you know, catch-up.
Yeah, like text summaries, like entries. Like, it's funny because when I accessed these early on, like the glossary, like the story recaps of Neo 1 and Neo 2, and there's like basically text entries. Neo 1 is very like, it's like one paragraph, one meaty paragraph of like the events of Neo 1. When you go to Neo 2, it's like you have to fucking scroll down. It's like a whole body of text. It's like, oh yeah, it got really chatty in Neo 2. It really expanded the story between Neo 1 and Neo 2. It was really funny. But once again, you don't need to know like these, like this is a very completely isolated story from.
Now I do expect I just expect that one of the secret bosses in this game near the end somewhere is going to be William. They're going to throw him in like somewhere, you know, it
like Advisor of the Ronin.
Yes.
I can't wait to fight Commodore Perry again as another boss fight.
Yeah. Or Ryoma. Just have him.
Oh god.
Yeah, you go to the Bakumatsu awesome, period actually. So actually, the, like I said, the
it's gonna be Ryoma in New York City.
Yeah, with a title.
Oh,
but yeah, like I said, in the demo I played last year, I did fight Shinsuke or whatever his name is, who's from Rise mm-hmm. of the Ronin. So like, it was a different character design. It wasn't like the same guy transplanted, but you know, the character from history or whatever was right there. So, but also the other thing I wanted to mention, and James might want to chime in on this one, is that playing the demo, the PC port seems actually pretty good.
It's the
good.
Best they've done.
Yeah, compared to like, compared to Wolong, compared to Neo 2, compared to Rise of the Ronin, and I've never played it, but Wild Hearts.
Wild Hearts, I would say the main problem with that is the stuttering, especially nowadays. But this one is like miles better than Rise of the Ronin, because I just played through Rise of the Ronin. That PC port is dog shit. I was able to push through it, but it's like it not a good port. This, it looks and runs.
They really cared. They really cared about the performance of the game. They're making sure to like, hey, that's a day and date on between its console release. We really like this is the one that like this is the one that matters, and they really it demonstrably gave it their all on like optimizing the shit out of this. Obviously, there's still going to be.
Yeah.
Go for it.
It's still a demanding game because it's like current gen only. So anyone that has a PC that's like 6 or 7 years old, you're probably going to run into some issues. You might want to cap it at 30 FPS. I know it's a Neo game. But especially with the state of hardware right now, if you haven't upgraded your PC within like that time frame, you got to do what you got to do.
But there are still like, you know, some people here and there that do have like some weird crashing issues, even like on boot up, like with more modern systems. So I think they're investigating that.
It looks like it might be mostly an RDNA 3 issue from what I can tell. Okay. Cause that was, it's the same engine as Yumi, like Atelier Yumiya, which had the same problem.
Interesting.
And Koei Tecmo has had a bit of a history of like weird issues on AMD cards, because I remember part of the reason I switched to NVIDIA was because when I was reviewing Wild Hearts when it first came out, even though I reported issues in Wolong on RDNA 3, they and they knew about it for like over a month. They didn't fix it. They did fix it in Wolong before launch, but they didn't fix it in Wild Hearts. So I did that review on my, at the time, laptop at very low settings, because otherwise it was literally just flashing neon rainbow lights everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's probably just like an AMD. Well, it's Koei Tecmo's weird issues with the AMD hardware that's been a problem for like half a decade at this point.
I know some people who were playing the demo had like experienced like some cutscene banding, like a weird line in cutscenes. I don't know if they fixed out the recent patch. And that's a bizarre issue too.
Yeah, I didn't have that, but I have seen it like reported. And I know that Adam, you mentioned noticing that, right?
I saw it in one cutscene, but then like the next few, I didn't see it. So I'm like, did they fix this already? Because I know the demo got an update, so maybe they fixed it. But yeah, I when I first got this error, so what it looked like a zebra stripe of some sort, where it was like bright, dark, like I could see the whole image, but like the lighting was off. I'm like, is my monitor bugging out? And then I saw other people saying that, like, oh, okay, it's the game. But I think it might have been fixed, and it doesn't seem like everyone has it, but no big deal now, I guess.
Yeah, sometimes it's hard to tell these days with PC issues whether you don't know if it's the game's fault or Windows 11 fault.
The other thing I wanted to mention is that I've been getting really into HDR lately, so I've been very curious about the state of HDR in PC ports. And I know that Rise of the Ronin's default HDR implementation wasn't very good, which is why there was like a Reno DX mod, which, if you don't know what Reno DX is, it's a reshade plugin that injects proper like tone mapping and all the information the game needs for HDR. So a lot of people that use HDR and PC, they'll specifically use those mods because HDR has been a crapshoot. And generally, it's like just better off to use those mods to get better tone mapping experience. That's why I use in Monster Hunter Wilds and what I use in like 14, actually. Point being, there's HDR in Neo 3. And the moment that I booted it up and I checked the HDR menu, I immediately knew they cared about this. Two things. Usually a game with HDR, they will default to 1,000 nits peak brightness or higher than that, which for like mini LED monitors, that would be fine. But a lot of people that are using HDR on PC with like OLED monitors, it's not going to work out that way. This one, it very clearly actually read the information from my HDR like stuff that I set up like in Windows 11, because instead of it saying, oh, 1,000 peak nits peak brightness, it said instead 800, which is what it's set to. And it's not something that you would come like choose unless you specifically were checking that data. And it also had a separate Paperwhite brightness slider, which is something that Durante did not do with Trails Beyond the Horizon, much to my chagrin. And it had like proper contrast. It's a good implementation, which is very rare. It's very, very rare.
Yeah, I recommend people when they like boot up the Neo 3 demo and the full game, like, hey, give every settings option, like look through the menus of the settings. Like there's a lot of options that you could tweak with in this game. Like they've had all out with the options in this game. Like I was impressed. I was like, wow, there's a lot of things you can tweak in this game.
Definitely sounds like there's a lot of, you know, a lot of excitement around Neo 3. So I know we were planning to have a shorter conversation this week, but I think it was still a worthy one. We'll just keep going into it next week with the full release on that. So definitely one that I've got on my radar. So
yeah, so I tried the PS5 demo. I tried the alpha actually for like just 2 seconds, because I remember if you like play the alpha, they give you some helmet or some shit in the game. They always do this, like this dangle, some useless item, but I always get baited. But I didn't finish the alpha, so I was like, let me try the demo. Demo was pretty big. Like, I think the demo on Steam was like 80 GB. I don't know what the hell they probably like shipped most of the game in the demo, but PS5 demo is really good. I was kind of afraid. I don't know. Same reason as Rise of the Ronin, right? I thought, is this going to be like during the open zone, is this just going to fluctuate like unstable? But so far, it's really good. Very happy with that. Based on what I've seen of the demo on Steam, though, like, this is not one to play on Steam Deck, but hopefully the full game, we'll see how that holds up. But yeah, I'm happy with the PS5 version. Steam Deck demo, not great. Haven't tried it on anything else yet, like on the ROG Ally or whatever, but enjoying the game. And I've been neglecting the samurai thing also. I should probably like give that more focus, because I just keep forgetting about that. Like I was too into like Neo 2, just didn't think of that.
It's yeah, cool that both styles are like feel competent. Like they, like there's just no like objectively one is better than the other. It's like it really depends on how you prefer to play the game. Like there's no preferable one. There's no right answer to them either.
Yeah,
go wild.
But yeah, like excited for the thing. Both. Yeah, excited for the full game.
Since you mentioned it, how's Code Vein 2 on Steam Deck?
They haven't, like, I haven't gotten my code to play that on this thing, but I was talking to a friend of mine who, like, runs Steam Deck HQ, and he got code for it the time when we got, you know, like, when the deluxe edition unlocked or whatever.
Yeah.
So I just, like, texted him and said, is it playable at all? And then he's like, I doubt it. And then, like, 3 hours later, he's like, do not even bother downloading it. So, yeah.
My Steam Deck caught on fire. Do not do this.
Yeah. I think, like, from the screenshot he sent me, it honestly looked like one of the worst, like, performing things on Steam Deck. And it's like, you know, when you have an Unreal Engine 5 game and you disable all the lighting, so it basically looks flat and, like, kind of like, I don't know what to say, it just looks like the game has not loaded correctly. Even with that, he sent me a screenshot of it at like 15 FPS in the first hour. So that's definitely, like, I'm excited for Cullen and myself to play the Switch 2 port. That's all I'll say.
That, oh man, it's gonna be crazy. It's gonna be crazy if, like, if Code Vein 2 and Neo 3 both somehow get Switch 2 ports, if ever. How that'll go.
Yeah.
I have to imagine if they're gonna do that first, maybe the both companies will try to do, like, their predecessors on Switch 2. Yeah. Who knows?
But yeah, Neo 3, like, I'm very happy the PC port for people who play on PCs is, like, shaping up to be pretty good, because whatever they did, like, I remember they improved Neo 2 compared to the dog shit Neo 1 port, but it was still kind of, like, not great. So, like, now at least I haven't heard major complaints from anyone, and, like, they released the demo, so they were confident.
Like I said, like, the biggest downfall, really, with Code Vein 2 is it released so close to Neo 3. Especially, even if you compare their demos, like, Code Vein 2 had a character creator demo, which is cool because you could spend hours on character creation if you really want to. But Neo 3 is like, go fucking create your character, which I was like, obviously the character creator isn't as good as Code Vein 2, but they, on top of that, you can play a lot of the game.
I will say, even if it's not as good as Code Vein 2, I think it's pretty damn close. You can really change, like, your facial shape fucking part of it. So
there's still, yeah, it's still very much like a very, like, comprehensive character creator, but it's just like, it's so hard to, when you're in a character creation competition, your opposite is Code Vein. I have to admit, at the very least, Code Vein has the leg up there, but even then, you do have a lot of options in Neo 3. But I feel bad for the timing on Code Vein, man, because when you just, like, when you play these both of these games and you're just like, man, Neo 3 is kind of really fun and Code Vein 2 is, like, has sparks and moments of fun, you're like,
it's okay.
if Neo 3 wasn't coming out in less than a week, I would have picked up Code Vein 2 because I did enjoy what I played at the preview event. But it's like, I'm sorry, Code Vein 2, I'm sure you're fine, you're no Neo 3.
And with that, I think we'll go on into, like, articles and news with one quick addendum here. We talked very briefly about a little bit of a side quest for us. Mikhail had mentioned that he had started Dispatch. Sounds like you finished and you had you asked me for 5 minutes for a very quick follow-up on your time through Dispatch.
Okay, so I don't remember where I had played when we recorded last week, but I was close. I think I had 2 episodes left. The way they released this in November was like 2 episodes every week, kind of like a whole month or 5 weeks. And that was like their first season, they call it, because it's like a TV show with some gameplay. So I finished it. I really enjoyed my time with it. The story was good. Characters good. I've seen how other, like, another option which I would have picked would have played out differently. And they actually had, like, the whole animation work for that choice. So it's not half-assed or whatever. So that was good. The one thing I was a bit confused about is I mentioned the management resource mini game, or, like, that's kind of the gameplay part, where you have to dispatch heroes based on what you think they do better when there's a task at hand on the map. Like, it'll be like, oh, my kid is stuck in a tree. You have to decide who you have to send over there. So, like, in the first 7 episodes of Dispatch, whenever you had to do this, if you failed everything, it didn't really matter. But the finale is when they actually make this gameplay part matter. So that was kind of dumb, because I feel like if you've gotten people used to not paying attention and not caring about how good they are at this, you're suddenly, like, railroading them into this thing where, oh, if you don't do this, you might get, like, not a bad ending, but you might not see some path play through or whatever. So that was kind of bad. But yeah, I played it on Switch too, and like it's been in the news. Like if you've been paying attention to any news in the last week of gaming, basically the Switch 1 and Switch 2 versions are censored. Like I didn't say that last time because I was under embargo, but there's been a lot of discussion about how like this is because like it had to release as one SKU in because Japan rating board and there's one SKU, so it affects every part of the world. But I think there's more to that story because it's just the North American version on the eShop where they had to even censor the art for the game over there, and there's more than nudity which is censored. Like there's one scene where a character flips you off and shows you the middle finger. Even that's blacked out on the Switch 1 and Switch 2 version. So it's kind of, I don't know.
To be clear, Mikhail, they also released, this was not available on PS5 in Japan until the same day they released the Switch version, which has the exact same censorship as the Switch version.
No, I get that. So like there's a lot of speculation as to what's happened, but like right now, from my point of view, there are two parties at fault over here. One is Ad Hoc for not making it clear that the Switch version and Switch 2 versions are going to be edited. And I saw them saying that, you know, like we tried, we had like, it's not easy to just update the store description, but like you have social media accounts, you could have posted this. And the second thing is, you can say all you want about like the PS5 version came out over there. Nintendo made them change the artwork for the North American eShop listing. So there's like more to the story. And now they're like, we're working with Nintendo and trying to like restore some of the content back and all. Like given what Nintendo's been doing recently with like, you know, Neptunia getting banned and stuff. Yeah. Like it's an unfortunate situation because I feel like Ad Hoc would have, even if they didn't release this game in Japan and just released it elsewhere, and had it like fully whatever, I think the sales would have like made up for it. Like right now you've just pissed off everyone, and I don't know like if that's going to work out for them, like if they like restore some of the content back or not. But yeah, I told Brian I'd take 5 minutes. So basically I enjoyed Dispatch a lot despite the dumb censorship, and I laughed at that part where the middle finger was censored. So like yeah, if you want to play it, like definitely play it, and I hope you can play it unspoiled. Like it has like the best use of licensed music in any media I've experienced since Cyberpunk Edgerunner. So like that's high praise from me. Absolutely recommended.
I think it's just unacceptable that they didn't have any prior correspondence about this, and they are figure them out for themselves.
The problem is like, you know, if this would have happened on Steam, no big deal. You can just get a Steam refund. But like getting a refund on Switch and Switch 2 is not easy. It's harder than even doing it on PS5, which is not easy as well. So like this is one of those situations that they should have just worked with Nintendo and said, you know, if people want a refund, like give them if you can or something like that. But it's just the whole like shit show over here. But I'm going to be interviewing Ad Hoc soon for like Nintendo Insider. So let's see if they even comment on any of this.
I feel like we're going to sidestep it, but yeah.
But like, whatever.
Yeah, definitely worth asking. Not saying don't ask, yeah. Saying definitely worth asking. It's just like, I just feel like that is such a, like, whenever I get around to this game, I will always think about this incident because this is enough for me to like damage like my trust in that studio. Of like, hey, you didn't tell your consumers up front like that this will have censorship? Like, that's crazy not to inform the public about that. Having it sucks.
I hope you enjoy it whenever you play it.
Like sucks, but like it's definitely like, why would you not inform the public of that? You have so many ways to inform the public about this prior to release. That should be something that should be, you know, a very obvious thing to do.
Yeah, I know.
People are going to spend money on it.
Yeah, and it's, like I said, difficult to refund. But yeah, like, whenever you get around to it, if they announce, like, Season 2 or whatever and you play this, I hope you get to experience it unspoiled, mm-hmm. because it's absolutely worth it, so.
Mm-hmm. With that, we'll go into our article shoutouts for this week. Only a couple for this week. One of them is a review that I know that James had mentioned he had been working on. I believe he had mentioned you had been working on.
Yeah.
For a game that just released literally a couple days ago, Steel Century Groove. We've mentioned this on the podcast before. It's an indie game that involves dancing robots. So just, James, I remember you said that you thought that this one was really promising. What ended up being your final thoughts on this?
I thought it was very good. It's most, like I said in the review, I knew it was a small team. I didn't remember there was like essentially just a solo dev. Like he got a couple of the songs on the soundtrack were licensed out with Creative Commons, but the bulk of the development was just the one guy, and it's like for a solo, like first indie project. I think he worked at like a AAA publisher before this. It's like, man, this is actually pretty damn impressive. Like,
yeah, I remember meeting this guy. I unfortunately don't remember his name at GDC last year. And I kind of offhand asked, like, how big is your team? And he was like, oh, me.
What team?
Yeah, like, it's just me. and I forget exactly what he said. He said, like, he had some, you know, assistants here and there. But it's like, it was just him demoing his game, like, as the primary solo dev for it. So
James has his review up on the site for Steel Century Groove. It's PC only for now, but seems like a very interesting, kind of quirky, fun title. And then our second of two features this week is one of Mikhail's standbys. You had a chance to look at and compare the different releases of Persona 3 Reload. So this is definitely your bread and butter. What's your thesis statement, your final conclusion on the performance of Persona 3 Reload across all the different platforms it's available on?
Okay, I'll keep this short. The Switch 2 version, too conservative. Atlas has fixed some of the major issues, but it's still not great. Right now, it's not the best portable version. That's like ROG Ally followed by Steam Deck OLED. And it's not the best TV version because it's like you have 1080p 60 FPS with a lot of cutbacks compared to 4K 60 on the other consoles with ray trace reflections. So like you're just getting a playable and like good version. You're not getting the version the console deserved. Besides that, the only thing I'll say is I can't wait to see the responses to the photo for this one for one specific reason. So I don't know if you want to look at it now on the podcast or not, but yeah, that my takeaway is like it's hopefully Atlas does better for their next Switch 2 port, but it's amazing on everything else though. So yeah,
I'm not gonna spoil the photo. It's fun. So if you don't know what we mean, you should follow us on social media at our RPG site. There you go. All right, an interesting number of like fairly fun new announcements this week of some. AA or you know mid-tier sort of games. And a few of these I have some interest in, and in no particular order here. I'll start out with this one. We got the announcement of a game that we've talked about on the podcast in the past, the newest entry in the Utoaro Romono series. At the time, we only had the Japanese title, Shirohino Micha Shirube, but it's been announced since then that it's going to get a worldwide release, including PC, so PC, PS5, Switch 2, and now has a fully localized title in addition. It's going to be, in the West, it'll be known as Utoaro Romono Past and Present Rediscovered, and it will launch on...
One slight correction. You said it's getting a worldwide release, including PC. It's like, it's only the PC version, it's worldwide.
No, thank you for the correction there. Okay. Worldwide release for that platform, also available on PS5 and Switch 2, in Japan.
Yeah.
It'll maybe, be releasing on May 27th.
Yeah, maybe it'll be like Monochrome Mobius, where, say, NIS America does the console versions down the line, but it's an unfortunate situation where Puravoon is only a PC development house, PC porting house, and their translation stuff they only do on PC. They don't release on consoles. And I guess part of the reason why Aqua Plus doesn't put the English translation in the console versions is kind of like leave the door open for like companies to pick it up themselves. But it's just frustrating, especially since we had the entire like trilogy ported to Switch last year, and those haven't been localized, even though like Aqua Plus owns the scripts. Like any company could have gone up to them and said, we want to localize these. Can we license this out? Because we know from the series history with those three games that Aqua Plus owns the scripts. Because Atlas did 1 and 2, but like Puravoon was able to do the PC versions. They did an extra editing pass. They didn't need much extra work, but same thing with Nice's work on Prelude to the Fallen. That PC version also Puravoon, a much heavier editing pass, but still, it's like, just, it doesn't really impact me since I play on PC, but I know a lot of Utoaro Romono fans or people that might want to get into the series where the fact that this series is essentially PC only in the West when it isn't PC only in Japan has been a bit of a pain point. It's
they haven't relisted some of the games yet, haven't they? I think it's only Prelude and Monochrome Mobius. I don't know if Xan is still available or not. I have to check that. But Mask of Deception and Mask of Truth were delisted because those were from Atlas and like Atlas under Sega or whatever. Like those got delisted, like you said.
5-year like licensing agreement or some shit.
Yeah, so like it was if you buy an expensive physical copy of that, otherwise there's no way to play that in English on console right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if there's talks behind the scenes with the Aqua Plus and now their new owner, Yuke's, of like this situation. Yeah.
They're gonna make a WWF Utaware Rumono game next.
Yeah. That'd be the best collab.
There you go. But it's weird stuff though, because
I remember back in the day when Nisa released both Utaware Rumono Zan and like Cold Steel 3 and 4. It's like, okay, why didn't you do the collaboration outfits for those two games specifically? You had the licenses for both. That should have been something you were able to do, and they just didn't fucking do it.
And also there was talk from the Aqua Plus themselves that like I guess past and present rediscovered is gonna be the final Utaware Rumono.
I wonder if that's being weasel words, because this is called Utaware Rumono, but it's very explicitly a sequel to Monochrome Mobius. I wonder if I do wonder if they're just calling this Utaware Rumono because the spin-off name for Monochrome Mobius, maybe they thought that that's part of the reason why that game bombed in Japan. Maybe it's not actually the end of the series, but it might just be like, this is the last Utaware Rumono. That's complete speculation. I have nothing that's specifically to base it off of, but it's just, I don't know. We'll see. There's a lot of ground to cover. I don't know why that game moved so glacially, but like Monochrome Mobius set up a lot of shit and answered none of it.
I think Aqua Plus should stop fucking around and collaborate with Shiravune for White Album too. That's what I think.
I would fully believe that they'd want to, but I think all that shit that happened with like Dungeon Travelers on Steam is why it hasn't happened yet.
Come on, man. You gave us White Album 1 already.
Because the thing is that like the Dungeon Traveler stuff, that was banned on Steam like over a year before they did the PC versions. And it's like, at the time, I wasn't able to say that I had talked with them behind the scenes. But the reason they didn't even fucking talk about it for so long is that they were worried about burning bridges with Valve, who are essentially the only place that sells games on PC. It's, yeah. If I were them, I completely understand. A VN that's about a romantic relationship in high school?
I know.
I would not waste the time translating it just because that's asking for trouble. When it's something like Type Moon, where they were probably able to just like get through it with Fate Stay Night, and even then, it's not even a high school story. That's one thing, but they've already been burned before. Aqua Plus isn't big. Shiravune is definitely not big. It's just not worth it. Not worth it. It sucks.
Damn, why did you destroy my hopes?
No, you gotta keep the faith alive, Chao. Despite what anyone says, you have to keep the faith alive, or else there's no point.
Convince DMM to release their Aqua Plus games on GOG instead of what's it called again? That terrible PC platform with
Joran?
Joran, yeah. I'm genuinely fascinated, and I want to try out Dungeon Travelers 2-2, but I will probably play it on my Vita because I am not buying that PC version on that platform. No. No.
This reminds me of they actually just released an official updated English localization to King Exit from the developers of Demon's Roots. And I remember talking about that several years ago because I wanted to play Demon's Roots because of how praised it was. And I really did enjoy that game, but I was like, okay, I'm gonna play through King Exit, and then like that game was already delisted from many places years ago because like there's a whole situation with its like abysmal English script like very machine translated. It's like I don't know if it was machine translated or it was just like really, really just incompetently done. Genuinely one of the worst English scripts I interfaced with in a video game. But they released that only on DL site, this updated English localization of King Yggdrasil, which is official, but it's only on DL site as far as I know. I was like, oh, interesting. But I mean, I get it in a sense, like that game is, it's very, very, very graphic with a lot of its premise and it's what you do in that game. But I was kind of curious because I was like, it's only on DL site. Yeah.
Your game had any weird DRMs when you got it from DL site?
I mean, I didn't get that game from the DL site, so I don't know what DL site's DRM stuff is. When I played King Yggdrasil way back when, before this updated English release, it was through piracy because there was no way to obtain that game legally. It was not up for purchase anywhere else, so I got it through piracy.
Makes sense.
The next news story we have here, I'm going to defer over to Mikhail because it's kind of a combination of an announcement. Plus, you were able to, it was like a roundtable interview that you had access to for I'll give you the title, Genii Gods Neza, G-E-N-I Gods. So this is a new action RPG that was announced just in the last week. It's got a publisher and a developer specific, like bespoke for the title, Genii Gods Lab. And it's in development for a ways out for 2028. For PS5 and PC, and it's going to get like some sort of official Sony support for the console release, potentially for the PC release as well. So, you know, tee me up here. Like, what is Genii Gods Neza, and what did you like? What was the experience you had with the roundtable of this announcement?
Okay, so Genii Gods Lab is a developer in China who's like done some mobile games for Sony, and they've been like doing a lot of work for like apparently for like over a decade now. I hadn't heard of them until I got offered this interview up by Alex, our boss. And yeah, it's an action RPG, and I, you know, usually I saw the key art and I was like, is this just going to be another Souls like, because like that's what 99% of the announcements are these days. But they actually were specifically like, they called it out multiple times saying that this is not a Souls like. They wanted to make an action RPG inspired by the older God of War games with like an elemental combat system, which also borrows from Street Fighter VI's modern style as an option. Because they said they want to make a game which has like a lot of cinematic combat built on the elements which they made a big deal about during the gameplay. They showed a boss fight in one of the trailers which they released. And yeah, basically it looked really nice. But then 2028, so I was a little concerned, like is this whatever? But they actually told me that they've already sent out a playable build of the game to Sony, and Sony is supporting them with like dev help and stuff, but they haven't announced anything beyond that, because you know, usually you'd think this is like a China hero project thing, but right now it's just Sony's helping them, nothing beyond that. And one more thing I found a bit interesting is, despite this, they said they're launching on PS5 and PC, but they are open to other platforms. They'll look into that later. Usually you don't really see this when like you have like a platform holder like helping out with the game, or you don't talk about it at least beforehand. So the interesting thing about the combat is like the gameplay which they showed, it didn't actually like tell me much about the UI and how the thing plays beyond a health bar. But I just asked about the accessibility, because like, you know, they said not a Souls-like, but they said they want it to be cinematic and they have this exploration in their open zones and all that. So they brought up Street Fighter VI's modern combat, and I don't know if you've played Street Fighter VI or not, but default is called like classic, which is like how Street Fighter is. You input button combinations, directional inputs, and then you perform skills. Modern combat lets you do it with less inputs and you have like a button you can hold to like do stuff. So what they want over here is people who aren't familiar with action games or RPGs, they'll be able to hold like R1 or something and then mash and then perform the combos for whatever, like, you know, in a boss fight that they're doing. That I found a bit interesting. And besides that, they said it's an Unreal Engine 5 powered thing. They're doing ray tracing and all that. But like, you know, we've like regularly spoken about how Unreal Engine 5 games usually run like dog shit on PC unless they've put in a lot of work. So I brought that up when I, like, during the roundtable interview, like, how are you dealing with that? And they brought an example of one of the games which they worked on, where they said that they are very familiar with scalability for the engine, that they were able to do hardware accelerated ray tracing in an iPhone 16 project which they showed last year. So they're pretty confident in the PC version, and they said Sony's supporting them with optimization stuff for the console version. So besides that, I'm kind of sold on the premise, because, like, you know, Adam and I, and Adam posted about this on Blue Sky, like, it's kind of cringe now when you get an email saying that, oh, Resident Evil meets Balatro or some crap like that. But like,
that,
over here,
sign
they,
up. That sounds yeah. awesome.
So, what so the fuck? Over here, the when, yeah. Imagine if you have, like, when you're doing your inventory in Resident Evil, you have to, like, play a roguelike with cards and stuff.
Okay, like that. I can actually get cool. What the fuck? This sounds awesome.
Yeah, hire me.
I would buy that.
So,
go on.
So basically, I was like, you know, if you say God of War 3, that's not really an RPG. So I was like, what RPG elements are you doing here? So they brought up they have this elemental system which builds on the Chinese mythology and the gods and stuff. Didn't go into more details about that, but they said that the complexity of combat is going to be in between God of War 3 and Black Myth Wukong, which is kind of a bit vague. But during the presentation, like, this wasn't posted in any trailer, they also had this like a graph where, you know how you have like chaotic, neutral and chaotic, you know, that the whole meme which people make. So yeah, this one had like, yeah. So this one had a chart which said, here's like, on this extreme is God of War 3, on this extreme is like whatever, like just hypothetical, like over here it's Sekiro, on top it's Elden Ring, and on the bottom is this. And they said our game is in between these two in terms of complexity.
What the fuck does that mean? Sorry, but like that means that is so funny to like have a fucking chart about that, and then like try to like, so, it's right here on the graph. It's like, so it's like 1/4 Sekiro, yeah, and like 3/8, I don't know, fucking yeah. God of War. It's like,
so,
okay. Well.
So because the gameplay video for the announcement, I mean, this could be anything, like it doesn't actually tell me much, but they were very adamant on saying, it's definitely an RPG. We have our elemental system, and it's gonna, if you've played Black Myth Wukong, it'll feel familiar, but it's not that complex and stuff. And they even had like this one interesting thing they showed us. They were talking about like their projected sales numbers for, they brought up Black Myth Wukong, which has done like, I think, 28 million or 30 or something like that. I forget the exact number. And then they brought up Phantom Blade Zero, which is coming out this year, which also, according to them, is like going to sell really well. And they are pretty confident in their game, because they expect it to be a series of three titles, which they build with this being the first one. I kind of like roll my eyes when you like say that for a game which is not out for a few years, but whatever, I'll hopefully they do a demo or something, because I want to try it out. Lost Soul Aside is like a game which someone else brought up like when talking about this one, and I believe right now it's in a much better state than it was at launch, so I need to like give that a shot as well, because I was enjoying the combat. It just ran like shit when I played it, so I want to give that a shot and see how it goes. But yeah, like, I like the aesthetic, what they've shown over here, but they've just shown one area, even though they said that you get, like, the freedom to move around, approach, there'll be bosses on the map and stuff like that, so it's all, like, kind of vague stuff, but I'm into the aesthetic they have over here, at least, so hopefully the combat delivers and doesn't remind me of that graph again, so, yeah.
Yeah, just really funny that they left off. It's kind of funny, they're also in their YouTube description, they describe this game. Chow, before I fuck it up, what's the pronunciation for Jenny Gods, and then it's not Neza or Neja. How do you pronounce
it? It all depends on what you speak. If you speak Cantonese, it's Naja. If uh-huh. you speak Mandarin, it's like Waja.
Like, what completely. If you speak English?
Well, I don't know.
You just mispronounced that. Sorry, I can pronounce it as Neza because I don't want to fuck up.
I don't want to offend people. Chinese, like, it's like when you look at the English spelling, it's like it doesn't match anything like Chinese. So.
I don't know. But they describe it on their YouTube description as like a premium pay upfront hardcore action role playing game, which is. I understand why they describe it as that. It's just really funny to see it spelled out like that, because there are many Chinese developers who are, you know, making these premium, like more traditional titles. It's not a free to play mobile game targeted platform sort of deal. There, like, a good chunk of Chinese developers are really like releasing, like, you know, like free, like premium traditional paid games Like, not just this game.
They had to highlight that in the
Phantom Blade Zero, Black Myth Wukong. But there's also one, I forgot the name of it already, that almost looked like Avatar The Last Airbender. A few weeks back, it was like also a Chinese-developed game, I believe, that had like a whole gameplay trailer that we talked about on the podcast. I already forgot its name. And then there's also that one, the Tides of Annihilation one, that was on a State of Play that kind of looked like Chaos Legion. It's just like, it's cool that like we're getting like all these sorts of like different titles that are just like, hey, you know, you don't have to contend with this free to play gotcha format. It's like you can just like one time pay up front. There you go. And them emphasizing that is good. It's good. I understand why they do it. It's just funny.
What about that Black Myth sequel that with the Exorcist guy?
They're working on the Black Myth Wukong or Black Myth series sequel, but I believe at that time when they showed it off at the Game Awards, it's like, yeah, this is really the only thing that we have on this.
So yeah, it was pretty bare bones, so I don't think we'll get.
I mean, it's like also a CG trailer, right? And they even admitted it's like we wanted to, you know, give people a heads up that we're working on this. We'll see it like in maybe 7 to 8 years. I don't know. Yeah. If that's the only thing they really have, it's like, okay, well, we'll check back in. And
I don't know, maybe this is why I'm so harsh in certain games like the Final Fantasy series. Like, you waited like 8 years for a sequel, so you're like extra harsh on it.
It's kind of, I mean, a lot of these games, like, I remember when Wu Chang first got like announced, Wu Chang Fall of Feathers, like, it was announced like almost like 4 to 5 years before it actually came out. Like, it was some time, and they just wanted to like let people know, hey, our studio exists. Please get excited for what we're working on. Here's a first look at it. That's how I interpret these early announcements. As like, they do have something.
Just to substantiate what you just said, so Wu Chang Fallen Feathers was first announced in summer of 2021. And then three years later, in summer of 2024, that's when they kind of like re-announced it, and then it came out the next year. So there was like that 3-year gap where it's just like they announced it. And I'm sure they had like, you know, small updates along the way, but it wasn't like re-revealed for 3 years later.
Yeah. So I get why they do it. It kind of, but it also runs this risk of like, I don't know if I'm going to remember this game like in 3 to 4 years when maybe it reemerges and it's ready. Like, I'm already struggling to remember the other game that also was an action RPG that was element focused. And I know that game in my head. I don't remember its title though.
There was also that other Sony PlayStation blog. So when Mikhail said like this is a God of War inspired action RPG from China, I'm like, didn't we just have like one of those talked about with the dead guy? Like, I couldn't remember what it was called. It was like Lulan, which was like on the PlayStation blog that was also announced relatively recently, that had like a similar phrasing in that action RPG, God of War inspired from China, specifically about like a, I guess like mythical kingdom called Lulan. But yeah, that one was also, you know,
it rings a bell, but I'm like, yeah, I don't remember any more than you do.
Get to this. I will probably play all of these games because they all look pretty cool, and it's definitely my kind of game. I'm interested. You know, I will definitely play these games.
Yeah, can someone give me an update on Showa, please?
Showa American Story?
Yeah.
That's... at least I'm tracked for this year. They had to delay it, but as far as we know, it's sometime this year till further notice.
Here's a quick announcement that I don't really know much about, but I read into it before the podcast, and it seems kind of interesting. This is from Devolver Digital and CD Projekt. They've announced a mobile and PC game coming out at the end of February called Reigns: The Witcher. I had never heard of this, but I guess the Reigns was a 2016 game that they released for mobile with a very, and I'm describing it as I read it, so I've not played it. This is not firsthand, this is secondhand. Like, you take the role of like an unnamed monarch who has like memory loss or something like that, and you have to just swipe left or right to make decisions in terms of like people coming up to you as like a monarch of a nation, and you basically just have to like make binary decisions constantly, which then like apparently evolve into like different scenarios based on your decision history. So Reigns the Witcher, we got a very quick, like, 1 minute trailer showing some of this with obviously like a Witcher theme to it. It's from the perspective of Dandelion, who is like the bard character in 2 and 3. I believe he might also be in 1. I don't remember. The trailer also shows some like very light strategy-esque like chessboard sort of stuff. I can't speak to it directly, but it does show up in the trailer. It just seems like a fun little project for Witcher fans. If you've played Reigns, or if you have any interest in that concept, coming out at the end of the month for it seems like a perfect phone game. Just kind of like swipe left and right, go through the scenarios, hopefully have some fun storytelling. It's available for pre-order now for like $6, so not a high, you know, premium title, but it is a pay up front, I suppose.
Premium. Yeah. I like the minimalist aesthetic to the art style, like the characters. They have like it's very blocky in a really charming way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like if Mies had actually like some design ethos.
interesting description.
I hate how Mies look, but I don't know. It looks cute, it looks fun. If you're a Witcher fan, it'll tide you over maybe to Witcher 4. Something to doodle bop on your phone, you know, while as a passenger in a car, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is the newest project from Compile Heart. We, in the middle of January, talked about the original teaser that we saw for it. It wasn't titled at the time, and Kite covered this for us. It's been revealed. It is Villian Code. I guess Villian is a portmanteau of, I hope I get my pronunciation right, Virion, which is like a part of a constituent of a virus, and Million, so Villian. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Villian Code. It'll be available in Japan for PlayStation and Switch consoles in June. So Kite's post goes into detail, all provided by Idea Factory and Compile Heart on this game. It has 6 different protagonists. It has some inspiration from like Buddhism in terms of like 6 elemental elements, consciousness, things like that. So for those that are real, you know, Compile Heart fans, this is a new IP from them. Other than that, I can't really speak to it, but
I'll go for it. Sorry. Yeah, you want to finish your thought?
Yeah, it's just Compile Heart, I don't have a high opinion of, but also I feel bad saying that because I haven't ever really played any of their games. So it's like, this is just me. I look at it, I'm like, not interested. But maybe other people have played more games from them and it is up their alley.
I feel like more people that have played Compile Heart games are inherently skeptical of Compile Heart games.
That's true.
It's a bit.
I saw this like Compile Heart games. I feel like the last good Compile Heart game was the original like PS4 release of Mega Dimension Neptunia V2.
Say that the tactical RPG Fairy Fence Ref was decent.
Okay. But okay, so the big thing with Villian Code is it they're kind of pulling a little bit of FooRyu here. I'm sorry to say. They are in promoting this game. They are using big, you know, names in the Japanese JRPG space, who worked on really highly lauded titles of the past from Atlas. Like the project producer of Villian Code is Koji Okada. Some people might know him as Koji because of his name sounding like Koji. A co-founder of Atlas, had a lot of involvement in the earlier Megami Tensei and Persona series. People who also will know Tadashi Satomi, who's working on the scenario for Villian Code, very much known for the scenario writing on the Persona 2 games and Persona 1. Another ex-Atlas alumni here is Tsukasa Masuko, composing the sound of Villian Code, worked on a lot of the, you know, early Megami Tensei games, even before Shin Megami Tensei, but also worked on early Shin Megami Tensei entries and that. And then obviously not ex-Atlas, but the character designer is Ilya Kuvshinov, and a lot of people in the West will associate this character designer as from the Ghost in the Shell anime series. Very iconic in that respect, though. You know, a lot of their work is very hit or miss for some people because of the way that they have a certain aesthetic style, art style to them. So that's kind of the main prominent staff in promoting this game. and a lot of the gameplay details as shared by Famitsu and the trailer for it is like this whole 360 degree exploration, and like that sounds weird. What does that mean? And basically, like the exploration when you're running around in this game, the maps are in basically a long tube, so you can run left or right, and you're going around the tube map exploration of the field So it's so as you're running forward, you can run around like almost as if you're in a tube, and that's kind of the 360 degree exploration. And like these maps are like procedurally generated. And it's I'll say charitably, it has been met with very mixed reactions when people have been, you know, seeing more footage of this game and seeing the Famitsu, what Famitsu's reported on in this game. Like, people are like, I don't know, like, some people don't like the character design. It feels like at odds with what the game is trying to present. It feels very, you know, it pops maybe in like not a great way, but also like in the gameplay footage that they shown off, people are very skeptical of how the 360 degree tube like exploration is shaking out. And then the whole battle system of the game, it's like it's hard to know exactly how the battle system is, what's happening in moment to moment based on the footage that they've given us. But it is reminiscent of like what you would expect in a compile heart game, both visually and maybe like the movement of it too. Is like, you know, you've seen it in other compile heart developed games where, you know, it's maybe not as higher up as like something you'd see out of like Atlas or Square Enix titles, for example, production values. Adam, what do you make of this? Like, it feels like it feels weird because in modern times, these ex-Atlas people are, you know, still making games from other different studios, and it feels like it's not hitting. You used to love these names based on their past works, and now we're just like, okay, we had Monarch, we had Caligula, we had...
When's the last time it hit?
Great,
when was the last time this played out?
Fuck. Ex-Atlas games? Modern games? I don't know if they ever hit. So maybe Caligula 2. I don't know if that was ex-Atlas people, though. I don't know if that they were involved with that. It seems like Caligula 2, maybe.
What was that meme again? It's like when you see your goat is now washed. It's like, what's the famous one? The Kazuma Kaneko?
Oh, yeah. We're not even going to get into it this podcast, but they're basically They're re-releasing that Kazuma Kaneko project that had generative AI for its card artwork that's trained on his style, but it's still very much a lot of generative AI in that. And they're re-releasing that onto Switch and shutting down like the previous version. It's like Kazuma Kaneko Tsukuyomi. That is peak. My goat is washed. God, man, fuck. I love that man's art style to death. I've had multiple art books of his. I own them before he ventured off into this, whatever he's doing.
A shell room.
Man, yeah. But yeah, Adam, do you have any thoughts to share on this villain code thing?
I don't know, like, Tadashi Satomi, like, I really like Persona 2's, you know, character and narrative writing elements, but then I played, like, Caligula 1, which he also was, you know, a writer on. And, like, I feel like, charitably, there's, like, one character in that game. I'm like, this is actually a really interesting take on a character, but the rest just, like, did not land for me. And apparently out of Furu's titles, apparently Caligula 2 is considered oftentimes the best one, and that's, like, the only one I haven't played. So one day.
Yeah, man, I don't know. Hopefully this villain code thing is cool, maybe, but everything is looking like no. I don't know. I feel like I love a lot of the work that a lot of these, you know, these staff have worked on when they were under Atlas, and now just like I don't know what the, I feel like my life is a lie at some point. I feel like me loving these ex-Atlas people at one point in my life, as more time has gone on, it feels like my life is a lie. It's like, man.
Well, later this year we're gonna get the Raido 2 remaster. It's gonna happen, and you'll be like, I like these Kaneko designs. Remember when Kaneko did designs?
And Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at least a lot of the newer designs, I forgot who was the protege of Kaneko now at Atlas. I'm forgetting his name off the top of my head.
Doi?
At least, Doi. Masayuki Doi. At least, his designs are starting to, get cooler and cooler as time's gone on. At first, I was like, I wasn't really feeling it with, the 4-4 Apocalypse era. But as time has gone on, it's like, okay, they have something. Like, I kind of dig their art style.
I actually saw someone just this past week lamenting that, they missed Trauma Center. And they actually noticed how Trauma Center designs from Doi, because that's what he did before SMT, were, just really kind of unique and varied and also, multicultural. Dark-skinned people, white-skinned people, Asians, very true. Non-Asians. Very true. So,
Trauma Team has some fucking ace designs. Yeah, Trauma Team is excellent in the character design department. I really hope those games actually, do get released. The Trauma series is genuinely one of the most interesting, games that, Atlas has worked on. And I don't know why they, decide to bury it. Because it's genuinely, really fun games.
So that covers us for, all the different little mid-tier announcements for the week. But a few games coming out relatively soon. I don't know why I said that. Not true for Jenny God's Nezha, which might be seen in 5 years. But anyways, a couple trailers for some previously announced games. Well, one trailer and one gameplay overview. The trailer is for the upcoming Trails in the Sky second chapter. It is a gameplay trailer. It is also moderately spoilery. So unless you're revisiting the game, if you started with Trails first chapter and you're interested and you want to play Trails second chapter, I think you already know that. This trailer, it is interesting if you are returning, because it kind of shows some later game events, and it toggles between the original, rendition of the events and then the rendition of the events in the newer style. So just in terms of a technical faithfulness, passing of the time kind of aspect, it's kind of neat. But if you're just interested in playing this game as a sequel to first chapter and you've not played it before, it's pretty spoilery, in my opinion, but it's a fun trailer to revisit, bookmark it, and revisit it later potentially.
Yeah, you'll see some of the villains, the main villain group in second chapter, their character models are show up in it and are great. I definitely dig them. But there's also the animations for some of the new crafts abilities in the game, there's one for Tita very over the top. It's I wonder how they're gonna do it in this game. It's they showed it, oh my god, that's fucking brilliant how they just
they literally show the whole S craft as it was, and then I think the whole F craft as it is now, and it's super well animated and it's very faithful, and it's
very lots of personality, lots of little touches, and Tita freaking out during it. It's perfect. Good job. I really love the spirit of the developers, the junior developers remaking the Trails in the Sky games. They have so many they understood the spirit of those games and really translated it almost flawlessly, visually and audio wise. It's great.
And then for the second video, it is a 15-minute features overview trailer for the upcoming Crimson Desert, which, if you don't remember, this is the single player open world action adventure game releasing in mid-March. So it is kind of related to Black Desert, but it is not multiplayer. It is not online. I did not actually watch this gameplay overview because I know that Adam did, and I believe Josh did as well, based on a few things that you shared in the Discord. So I'll head it off to Adam and then Josh. I know both of you have kind of talked about and had an opportunity to go hands-on for Crimson Desert in the past. So Adam, I know you watched the gameplay overview trailer. Any big things to pull out of there from what you saw?
I remember when Crimson Desert's been in development for quite a while now. And I remember we kind of joked here on this podcast years ago that it kind of felt like it was trying to be the everything game. In terms of an open world action RPG adventure platformer, game. And when you go down the comments on this YouTube video, which this video has been viewed a lot, I see similar sentiment. Does this game just have absolutely everything? Because it does feel like it's trying to be as broad as possible and as huge as possible. And they talk about the main character Cliff, who's been the main character for a while, They do mention that there are two other playable characters, and they show them briefly. There's like a woman who rides on horseback, or at least that's what the trailer shows. And then there's like another person who has like a gun. They don't really introduce these characters, but they just mention there's two other characters. There's factions, there's quests, there's like major quests and forts to that you can like liberate or whatnot. Then there's smaller quests where I think it shows like you can like help someone transport like stuff on a wagon through like a rocky terrain, like something a little bit more quaint. And then there's like this, I forget what it's called, like the Abyss or something like that, where it's like some sort of like, there's some sort of like spectral, spatial, like weird realm that like exists in the sky, but interfaces with the world that you're finding these kind of like weird artifacts in. It kind of reminds me of like Assassin's Creed or something, hopefully better. And then to Josh's amusement, at one point in the trailer, they're like, you also get a missile firing mech.
Where do I get this game? Where do I buy it?
it just seemed to come out of nowhere, because it seems like it's relatively grounded in like fantasy, and you know, obviously there's like magic and stuff, but like it seems like for a while it's like, you know, fantasy land, fantasy world, and like and a mech and dragons, but also the mech.
So. Yeah, that was it's one of those games that like, because there's on paper, if it like if this does like everything that is trying to do well or competent or like in fun or engaging, like this could very well be like one of the best games of the year if it manages to be able to like balance these things in like a really fun way that doesn't feel sluggish or tedious. Like on paper, this game looks like it looks like a lot of fun, but there's always that like, what's the catch? Like I'm watching this and I see a lot of cool stuff, but always in the back of my mind, I'm sure a lot of people share this sentiment, like, what's the catch? Because there's only so much a video game could do. You know, and like this game is like trying to do a lot of stuff, like because it's like you have like the, like you said, Adam, like these different factions and like these different faction quests and all these different like moments. Like I really like this trailer because it finally shows what you're doing like in the game, like outside of like these boss battles. Because a lot of the promo cycle of this game is like, hey, look at the combat, look at these boss battles, and like I'm like, okay, but what do you do besides these boss battles? And how what's the exploration look like? What do the zones look like? What can I expect out of like, you know, when I'm not in combat, what am I doing? I do like that there are some quests, like, you're just simply, like, riding a wagon, and that's kind of it. You're able to, like, you know, escort this, like, person back to wherever. Hopefully, like, the wagon gameplay doesn't feel, like, you know, doesn't feel boring, but I do like that there are slow moments in the game where you can, like, kind of take in the environment, because it does look like a genuinely beautiful game. And there's, like, also one section in this game where you're, like, in a misty, foggy forest. And the way that you're like platforming in this is like doing like this like spell to like almost do like a hop or jump, like where you're like lifted up, and so you're able to, you know, maneuver this space in non-conventional ways, because you do have like this maneuver or spell in which you're able to like propel yourself up. It's like not just like a double jump, it's like an actual like ability that you use to prop yourself up and glide to like different platforms in this like misty forest environment, these little platforms on the trees, you know. I'm like, okay, that's really cool.
This is in jest. I'm going to joke here, but you can tell, you can see the Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild influence, because they give Cliff like a paraglider, only it's not a paraglider, it's like a magic flying cape thing that you can do some stuff with. So
yeah,
so like some of the moments in this big trailer show him literally like magically gliding across like the gigantic landscape in his magical cape paraglider thing. So
yeah, but like even like in like the like 11-minute, 18-second mark, like you see like this whole like the setting of like a circus in front of you, like a little like balloon over the circuit, like the circus environment, and then the NPC variety that you have, like they have like a jester in costume promoting the circus. You have kids gathering around this jester, and like just kind of this fun filled environment. I remember like in our preview hands on when you went hands on with it, Adam, like, you appreciated, like, hey, like, it's cool that, like, the way that you're depicting, like, these NPC settings, it's, like, it's people of all age groups, because that's believable, you know? That it's not, like, it feels like it's not, like, hindering itself, like, in, like, a weird, like, non-convincing setting. It's, like, yeah, in this case, like, it would make sense, like, you know, that families are, you know, traveling together. It's not just, like, upfront soldiers. Like, there are just normal citizens of all age groups interacting and trying to survive together, and what do they do for fun in this world? And it's like you kind of get glimpses of that in that portion of this trailer. It's like, like I said, if they're able to somehow pull it off and make this all feel great and fun to explore, like, this could very well be, like, a really top-tier contender for this year in terms of, like, best games.
You know why I made that comment about the character, like, variety in the NPCs? Because I think of, like, Kingdom Come Deliverance, which I think Kingdom Come Deliverance 2, if you talk about on our Game of the Year podcast, is a really excellent game, but there are, like, no children, and there's, like, no old people, few old people, but a lot of the NPCs are all just kind of, like, your more typical man and woman, you know, age 20 to 50. That's it.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So there's, like, no children exist in this world, apparently.
Yeah, you know, I have the same thought when I was playing Resident Evil as a kid with my friends. They're like, there's always, like, adult zombies and stuff, but where's the kid zombies?
Kids, like, are the mansion. Maybe what happened in that mansion is, like, maybe a gathering only for, like, you know, no children allowed. I don't know. What happened in that mansion?
No, but we're even talking about Raccoon City here.
You're right. Yes, like Resident Evil 2, yeah.
We also have a couple updates from previously released games from Square Enix. These are all kind of different flavors of different small little updates, so I figured I'd kind of rattle through them here because they're all a little bit interesting. First of all, the most interesting, in my opinion, and the one I'll just arbitrarily talk about first, is that Square Enix is releasing a new version of Final Fantasy VII on Steam, the original PS1 version, and the older version is going to be renamed specifically Final Fantasy VII 2013 edition. So Square Enix provided some levels of detail about what this is, but not as much as maybe should have been explicit, though people have, you know, kind of read between the lines about what this actually is. From Square Enix directly, they said they're going to be releasing a new version. I don't think they gave a date. Adam, did they give a date on this, or just
they plan to do it? Now, January 31st, I think, is the anniversary of Final Fantasy VII in Japan, like when it first released. So I was wondering if it was going to line up with that, but I don't think it has. Maybe on Monday.
Yeah, we're recording this on the 31st. Yeah.
Yeah. There's no date for it.
They say when the new version launches, the old version will no longer be available for purchase, but people will be able to have access to it. All players who already own the 2013 edition will be able to get the new version at no additional cost, and both versions will be accessible in your library. So you could play either version if you have both. Save data is not compatible, so old version is stuck with old version, new version stuck with new version. Adam, and I know others as well, but what, reading between the lines, what do we think this is?
So I remember maybe 5 years ago or whatever, I was deciding where should I play Final Fantasy VII, the original version. I can play it on Steam or I can play it on PS4. And I think the Switch version came out roughly around that time. And the Steam version of Final Fantasy VII is kind of junky. And it was like one of the very first ports that they did to Steam. And it's got like the old Square Enix account DRM, like you have to log in. I don't know if you have to log in to play it, but it asks you to log in to play it. And it has like some built-in cheats that a lot of Square Enix games have now, but it's like you have to like go to the website and like it's like server-based and not like application-based. It's very strange. It's a very weird port, and it's actually missing some of like the extra features that like the PS4 version had or the Switch version had. So at the time, back then, I'm like, I'm just going to play the PS4 version because it seems like a slightly better port of Final Fantasy VII. Not like a remaster like Final Fantasy VIII, but just like a slightly better port. And so my guess is for this new Steam version is, I'm guessing, we don't know because they haven't said, that it's going to be more or less making it in line with the PS4 version and the Switch version and the Xbox version. Because right now it's not. The Steam version is like clearly older and weirder. That's my guess.
And then on a similar front, but not quite the same, Square Enix has also announced, well, I guess actually GOG announced this, that Final Fantasy IX, Final Fantasy VIII Remastered, Final Fantasy III and IV, the 3D remakes, are now available on GOG as part of the GOG preservation program. This is their program where they regularly test games with OS updates to make sure that they're always going to be playable, that they're never going to fall like and be technically out of date in that sense. And of course, you know, GOG is DRM-free, so just good from a preservation standpoint. I presume the new version of Final Fantasy VII will also make its way over there, but that's me speculating. That's not announced. But yeah, Final Fantasy games. If you want them on GOG, they are, are now available. I just wanted to make sure. And they are also on a pretty steep discount until next week.
The one thing I'm confused about with Final Fantasy VII, just to like go back for a second, is there's a Windows Store version of that, which released like after the Steam version, obviously, because the Windows Store wasn't even a thing back then, as far as I remember. So I don't know if this is like going to be a port of that, because remember there was this Nier Automata drama where the Windows Store version of that was better than Steam, and then like people had to like, you know, like review bomb, but like essentially you've released the better version and not fixed the dog shit port of your very successful game until like much later. So I wonder if this is going to be the Windows Store version getting ported over. If it, I don't own that, because I did not realize that, you know, the like Adam brought this up, that if you want to buy Final Fantasy VII Remake Integrate on Xbox and Switch 2, they have this early purchase bonus version with like that on the artwork. I was not aware that if you buy it on Xbox, you actually get Final Fantasy VII for Windows 10 and Final Fantasy VII for Xbox included with your remake purchase. It's not like one play anywhere build. You literally get two different extra apps in your account. So I just wonder how they're going to handle, like, is that what's going to get ported over, or what's going to happen? Because they literally didn't say anything. So besides removing the DRM and cheats or whatever, I believe there's like these lip movement things also. I was talking to some people who like work with Final Fantasy VII mods and stuff. So isn't it weird that they just announced that and didn't actually like say when it's coming or whatever?
Yeah, they didn't even say soon. They just said it's coming eventually. Like, okay.
And like when I brought it up to you, like when I told you like in the staff chat, when I said, why did they randomly dump the Final Fantasy VII soundtrack on Steam? And then you brought up because the anniversary, which I forgot about. And that just happened. Like they posted on their social saying we're celebrating the 29th anniversary by showing some concept artwork and a message or something. And I feel like, you know, this is the, you should celebrate it by like releasing your new version and like putting all the platforms on discount and like, here, play this game. But like, I don't know, just bizarre how they're handling it.
And they didn't even, like, we already mentioned this, but just keying in, they didn't even really announce anything other than it's a new version. They didn't really say like what they're changing. So all of that's kind of interpreted.
Yeah, I saw some people wondering if it was going to be like Final Fantasy VIII Remastered, where they redo the character models, but nothing else. But then people kind of quickly said, like, well, Final Fantasy VII doesn't even have, like, regular proportion models. Like, it'd be kind of weird if they redid the character models, how they would do it. So I doubt that's the case. I highly doubt it.
And that would be, that information, if that were the case, would have been presented differently, I think we all believe.
Yeah.
And so it would have been shown off. So I do agree that the removal of the old DRM and making it in line with the console version seems the most likely, but it is not actually confirmed, to my knowledge, is that that's what this is.
Nope.
And then the final one, this is real quick. An update to Octopath Traveler Zero, which normally I would not cover, like just little tiny patches after games release, unless they have something interesting in them. The only thing I thought was in here that I thought was kind of neat is that they do explicitly say that they updated Octopath Traveler Zero to try to improve the sound quality. Because I remember that kind of showed up in some of the reviews and discussions of the game, that it felt tinny and flat.
Yeah, the English like voice acting was really compressed or low quality for some reason.
Yeah, so yeah, I have not made a comparison directly, but they have called it out in their patch notes that they have attempted to address that. A couple sales updates. Hyrule Warriors Age of Imprisonment has sold over 1 million copies. Monster Hunter Wilds has sold more than 11 million copies. And speaking of Monster Hunter Wilds, it has been in kind of the news a lot lately for lately since it's released, for like performance issues, but specifically about performance issues related to DLC checking. So I forget where it was originally reported, but someone's like, hey, I think I found this, and Digital Foundry picked it up and said, let's us look into it. And they said, yeah, what you found about it performing worse the less DLC you have was largely correct in certain circumstances, and Monster Hunter Wilds did get a fix to try to address this, as well as various other performance issues that still plague that game. I do not know that, I have not booted this game up since like a while ago, like last summer. So I do not know if my personal performance has improved, but it seems like the Steam I remember Josh, you showed like a quick little snippet of Steam performance like reviews in terms of like people seem to think it's doing better, but
it was Mikhail who shared that. And but I've heard from Mikhail, other okay. but from what I hear from other friends, like a lot of their performance issues have been, you know, it's been way more smooth now, so they're starting to play it a little bit more. Now that
the performance is improved, but one thing I will say that annoys the shit out of me is they said specifically the big thing that this patch was going to do was also improve the experience of using the HD texture pack. That was a lie. That was a bold-faced lie. The way they fixed it is that they
downgraded it.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's a fix. Like,
and the whole reason I wanted it is that the default high textures look terrible in some instances.
So they probably thought like five people playing the game have 1590, like they won't notice. Let's just do it and quickly fix it. But yeah, I heard that from another friend also, and he was like, how are you telling me everyone's happy with the performance? I was like, I don't know. I'm going by Steam reviews. I haven't like touched the PC version since I wrote about it. I play on PS5. And then he's like, no, they made it ugly on, he has a 4090. He's like, no, it looks much worse now. I was like, I don't know. I'll ask James, I guess.
But besides that, the overall performance has improved. So it's like, it's not all bad. And if you weren't going to be using the HD texture pack, well, I mean, at this point, since it uses way less VRAM, you might as well download it because it still is an improvement from high. It's just the environmental textures are not as good as they used to be. Man.
Is there no way to like even put it at like ultra or whatever? Like they just literally downgraded
They literally downgraded it because it was like a DLC. It used to be it was like 100 gigabytes to download the HD texture pack. Now it's like 35.
Oh, weird.
Yeah.
Is that getting like, you know, is that on Steam? Like are people talking about that at least? That because the game is like, it's at like 60%. It used to be at like 20% a few months ago in positive, whatever. But the HD texture pack, let me like have a look at it quickly. I'm on Steam. The HD texture pack, it was mostly negative. Now it's become mixed. But I assume people are saying it's usable now. Thank you for fixing it. But either they didn't notice it or they weren't using the higher setting, I guess. Is that what you think is happening?
Yeah, let me look at the reviews. The two highest rated reviews, they reduced the file size by over half and fixed the issue. The second highest rated, they completely butchered the texture pack to the point that the store page screenshots do not represent the actual texture quality that this pack gives. After a new patch, installing this DLC is basically pointless. A high resolution texture pack should be high resolution, not what it became after this update. We'll gladly change review back to positive if the issue is fixed. And it's like, yeah, it's... I feel like if you're using this at like 1080p or even like 1440p, you might not notice that it's been downgraded to the extent that it has, it's not nice. I mean, it's an optional DLC for people that knew what they were getting into. If they couldn't fix the issues of direct storage, I don't fucking... This really pisses me off, honestly.
Wasn't this the thing where someone had a mod which like duplicated the texture? Yeah, decompressed. Sorry, not duplicated. So what happens with that now? Like, I guess that's not needed because they just made the textures worse. Well, so you won't run into those issues.
Well, I guess technically what you could do is if you had those textures backed up, they're still using the same file names for the textures. So if you do the same symlink stuff that you would do to get it working before and you have 500 extra gigabytes on your hard drive, you probably could do that. You shouldn't have to.
There's two other headlines here at the very end. One's quick and one's actually an indie game shout out. So first out, we talked about this when the Switch 2 first released, the short, fun, little interactive adventure game Dear Me, I Was from Arc System Works. It will now also be coming to Switch 1, Steam, and mobile devices on February 12th.
Good game. It's it's a short game, but deliberately so. But definitely, if people are wanting like an interesting narrative experience that has no voices whatsoever, it's definitely give it a shot. It's a really profound game.
And then this last one is a little quick indie shout out here. I had not heard of it before looking at it right before this podcast. It is called Under the Island from Slime King Games. It is a 2D action RPG that's launching on February 17th. It's launching on, as far as I can tell, most platforms, Switch, PlayStation 5, Xbox, and PC. Not explicitly Switch 2, just Switch 1. It looks like kind of like a, it's got kind of like that GBA Pokemon look, sort of it, but with also with like top-down Zelda kind of gameplay, swinging sword, picking up items. Only the character is like swinging a hockey stick, and there's, you know, it's got a fun little, it reminds me of like, like a quirky little GBA RPGs is kind of what it reminds me of. So I don't know much else about it. It was not on my radar until like an hour ago, but it looks like it could be a cute game. And I don't know much about the pedigree of the developer either, Slime King Games. But yeah, Under the Island, launching in about 3 weeks. So on multiple platforms. So if you like little indie RPG experiences, this one might be up your alley. Take a look at the trailer on RPG site. And that covers us for the topics that I had listed on this episode of the Tetracast. As we've kind of talked about, next week is going to be a lot. We have, of course, the release impending for Dragon Quest VII Reimagined. We've got, of course, follow-up discussion on Neo 3. There are rumors of a Nintendo Direct, so if that happens, that almost certainly involves games that we will want to cover, because those events always do. So if that happens, that will be covered next week as well. So bookmark us for then, and we'll reconvene in 7 days.
We're screwed if we have the directs happen. Oh my god! Because we have two big games to talk about, and then whatever these Nintendo directs seem to be chock full of RPGs these days.
And not only that, but they're like, it's not uncommon for there to be like, there's a new Paper Mario. It comes out in 4 weeks or whatever. Just like, okay.
Well, the rumor, for that. And all these rumors are everywhere, is that it's like a partner direct. But even so, like if it's a partner direct, Square Enix will almost surely, they
probably Falcom.
Atlus will announce Rido 2. That's my prediction.
There you go.
So
along with Devil Saga 1, the HD remaster or whatever.
And Devil Survivor.
I think FF9 remake. FF9 remake for sure.
It would not be announced at a Nintendo Direct, but related. I wonder when the Bravely Default remaster will go to other platforms, because I imagine that's
good question.
I expect that just to be like a shadow drop on a random like Tuesday. Just like, by the way, it's out now on Steam and PS4 and Xbox. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I expect it any minute now.
That reminded me of like how out of nowhere the Trails second chapter trailer just dropped. I was like, oh yeah, Taipei Game Show's going on. That's why it got dropped.
So you can find RPG site on all the social media networks. Sorry, my brain just blanked there for a second. Like, how do I wrap this up again? Just search for RPG space site on any social media platform and you should be able to find us. Shout out again to the two articles that went up this week, the Steel Sentry Groove review and the comparison for the technical performance of Persona 3 Reload across all the different versions. You can join our Discord, discord.gg/RPGsite. If you like this podcast and you listen to it, you can leave us a like or leave us a rating on whatever podcast service you listen to us through. We'd like to see that. We'll be back next week with discussions on Dragon Quest, Neo 3, and potentially a Nintendo Direct. We'll see. Until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care, and we'll talk to y'all later.